Boy, that's sort of muted. Good afternoon. Welcome to the Senate Environment and Natural Resources Committee for January 13th, 2010. Welcome, committee members. And this is our last meeting during the interim before the February session. I just want to let folks know that we're going to have a little shifting of the agenda because I'm going to lose some committee members throughout the hearing. So right now we have a quorum. So we're actually going to start with our work session to introduce committee bills. And I just want to be clear for folks who are new or just to reiterate for the committee members that voting to introduce a bill does not necessarily mean that you support the content of the bill, but it's to introduce it into the committee so we can have a discussion during the February session. The hearings today are only informational hearings. The actual public hearings will be the first week of February. And you probably know as the schedule, I'm assuming the schedule is public, this committee will be meeting on Tuesdays and Thursdays from 1 to 3 during the February session. So with that, I will open up a work session and entertain a motion.
Madam Chair, I move that LC 113, which is dated 1/13/10, be introduced as a committee bill.
Okay, and I just wanted to mention before, let me just state that Senator Przanski moves that LC 113, dated 1/13/10, be introduced as a committee bill.
I'm sorry, this should be 12.
Today is the 12th, it is. Is there any discussion?
No, today's actually the 13th, but it came out on the 12th.
Yes, it came out on the 12th.
What am I doing?
Okay, is there any objection? Seeing none, it's introduced. And I just wanted to mention for the record before we move on to the second bill that, because there's a number of folks in the room that have been working diligently on a work group, we are still going to be meeting actually even prior to session to discuss the language, and then we'll be having a hearing in February. So I wanted to make sure and thank everybody. There's been a lot of work already put into it, more to come, and just wanted to thank everybody for their hard work so far. And I'll entertain another motion.
All right. So, Madam Chair, basically, I guess what I'm hearing is these are just vehicles to the final products that may come about through the regular session.
Correct.
With that in mind, Madam Chair, I move that LC 116, which is dated December 31st, 2009, be introduced as a committee bill.
Senator Przanski moves that LC 116, dated 12/31/09, be introduced as a committee bill. Is there any discussion? Any objections? Seeing none. The measure is introduced as a committee bill. And with that, we will close the work session and reopen the informational session. And first up, and as you can see, so on the agenda, we'll be a little bit of ahead of the times, a little bit behind, about 5 minutes, but we'll try to make sure that folks get their full time allotted to them. So next we're going to hear on an issue that came to the forefront last session. This is about cyanotoxins, which you're going to hear a little more description about. We have a couple panels that are going to come up and discuss this. I went to the meeting that DEQ organized. It was the beginning of an informational meeting that was very helpful. But this is an issue that's been a problem in our state for quite a while. And I'm really pleased to see that there's a group coalesced to try to see if we can solve this problem. I think the folks from the agencies are going to set the stage, and then we're going to hear from some of the advocates and also from, I think, some consultants who've been working on this issue as well. Beth, did you want to add anything?
No.
Okay. So the first, is it just the first three, the agencies that are coming up? We're going to hear from the Department of Human Services, from the Department of Environmental Quality, and the Department of Ag. And if you could all make sure and introduce yourself when you come up, and each panel will have about 10 minutes because I want to leave some time for questions. So if you can, I'm not, as you know, shy about cutting people off, so just we'll ask if you can get your key points out. If you have presentations, please don't read them because we're pretty good at picking up on stuff, but we want to make sure there's time for questions as well. And thank you all for coming today. Curtis, you want to start?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Curtis Coode. I'm a program manager for environmental public health tracking and hazardous incident tracking in the Oregon Public Health Division. And today I'd like to take a few moments to describe how we coordinate responses to harmful algae blooms and share with you what we've learned over the short course of our program about algae blooms in Oregon.
16.
Okay. There we go. Prior to about a year ago, our algae bloom efforts were coordinated pretty much on an ad hoc effort through available toxicologists and other agency staff. We are fortunate in the last year to receive a grant from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention to help track the prevalence and extent of freshwater and marine algae blooms, as well as human and animal exposures to those algae blooms. The main thing that we've been able to do with this program is to coordinate agency response to harmful algae bloom events and to alert the public when a toxic bloom is detected. Some of the other benefits of the program is there is a federal data system that allows us to track all of this information, and we're able to better maintain partnerships with the various agencies, stakeholders, interest groups that are involved with harmful algae blooms. And another key component is to raise awareness about the issue. So some of the concerns, and you'll hear a little bit more about this in a while, about the public health concerns related to harmful algae blooms, is that some of the symptoms range from skin irritation through gastrointestinal symptoms all the way to nervous system disorders, and in the case of animals, sudden death from exposure to these toxins. Again, children and pets are at the greatest risk of becoming sick from harmful algae blooms. On the screen here, we have some of the messages that we include whenever there is an algae bloom, that we help to notify the public when there is a concern. So what have we learned in the last year about algae blooms? First of all, I would like to point out that the Departments of Agriculture, in partnership with the Department of Fish and Wildlife, maintain a marine shellfish safety program, and those agencies monitor the coast for cyanotoxins in the water, as well as cyanotoxins in the shellfish tissue. And you can see over the course of a year that there are various shellfish advisories posted for the coast. And as a matter of fact, at this point in time, the north coast from the Nacanicum River north to the border is closed with respect to recreational clam harvesting. The primary focus of our program has been on freshwater blooms, and this graphic will give you an idea of the extent of the information that we know about algae blooms, both for over the past several years. First, I'd like to draw your attention to the table on the right of this figure, where you'll see that over time, from the year 2005, where we really start to have some consistent reporting for algae blooms, you see that the number of advisories and the number of water bodies that were posted for algae blooms has increased over time. Now, what we're not sure about at this point in time is whether that increase is a result of environmental change or if it's an increased awareness about algae blooms, and therefore we're getting more reporting. Over time, we should be able to help to discern the difference there. The map that you see on the left is a risk classification for the various water bodies that we have issued advisories for over the past few years. And you'll see a number of red, yellow, and green dots on the map, and those indicate the relative risk for algae blooms, for toxic algae blooms. And this is based on the maximum concentration of harmful algae, the frequency with which the blooms recur, how recent in the past have these water bodies bloomed. And you can see that we're gathering more information over time, and this will help us focus our efforts with outreach and perhaps down the road with mitigation efforts as well. In terms of illness reporting, we really started that in 2009. And just to summarize what we've learned in the last year, we've received 18 reports of illness from algae blooms, and that is actually a combination of fresh and marine algae blooms. And the typical scenario that we see is that someone has gone swimming in a water body that has a posted algae bloom, whether or not they were aware of that posting. And they come down with symptoms typically having to do with a rash of some kind, sometimes gastrointestinal distress. We had 10 animal cases this summer, and the most significant was an event down in Elkton, at the confluence of Elk Creek and South Umpqua River, where we had a number of dogs die from exposure to anatoxins next to the river. So at this point, I'd like to inform you how we're able to coordinate interagency effort with respect to harmful algae blooms. Typically, I'll start first by speaking about a managed water body like a lake or reservoir and go from there to more atypical situations where the local water body manager, in this case I'm thinking of the Army Corps of Engineers who is maintaining a reservoir or the Forest Service who is maintaining the lands around the lake, they will observe an algae bloom that's starting to appear. And at that point in time, they'll take water samples. And if those water samples, if the amount of algae in those samples exceed a certain amount, they will inform us that there is a potential toxic algae bloom. We will work with the local stakeholders, with the local health department, and with our colleagues in DEQ and other agencies to develop a press release, inform the public, and then continue to monitor until the algae bloom has died off. In certain other situations, the local water body manager is not so apparent, and that might be in the case of a river or a creek, and that takes a little bit more extensive coordination, which I believe over the last year we've been able to really improve our efforts in that way.
Curtis, just can you explain where the county health department fits in here? We discussed it during our meeting, but since they're the sort of local point of contact, where do they fit in this diagram?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the local health departments, they are the local health authority. At the point where a public health advisory is warranted, we contact the local health department and consult with them to advise them so that they are aware. Certainly, once a public health advisory is issued, they will start to receive calls from the local media and local citizens as well. We certainly, at the public health division, receive many of those calls. And again, once we get to the point of lifting that advisory, we also reach out to the local health department, consult with them, and then we go ahead and lift that, and they're aware. And at this point in time, that concludes my presentation, and I appreciate your attention. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Curtis. Christine, why don't you go ahead, and then we'll take questions at the end for the whole panel.
For the record, my name is Christine Svetkovich with the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality. Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, I don't have any comments at this point, but we're here to answer questions, as is Ray Jandel from the Department of Agriculture, if any come up.
Okay, well, maybe you can talk a little bit about the work group, and I don't know if that's something you want to continue on a regular basis, but maybe talk about how you're coordinating that with the different agencies.
Sure.
And I think it would also help for the committee to understand the role that DEQ plays versus the Department of Human Services versus the Department of Ag. Like, you know, something happens, who's responsible? Who's responsible for stopping it from happening in the first place or preventing it from happening, and then once there is an outbreak? It sounds like it's DHS's job to make sure that the word gets out, but maybe you can just clarify that.
Sure. Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, first I'll briefly talk a little bit about DEQ's role related to cyanotoxins and blue-green algae. We actually don't have water quality standards for those specific pollutants, but there's a number of other pollutants that are indicators of potential issues related to blue-green algae, and so our job is to work to make sure that those pollutants are managed in a way as best as possible so that we don't have blooms. When we do have blooms, then we work very closely with the Department of Health, and depending on whoever the land manager is in the area of the bloom, to figure out how do we respond on that end. And so we, a lot of times, will help with the monitoring when there are blooms and potentially the analysis of the samples that are taken. So that's to get just DEQ's role. In addition, we, as many of you know, we work on developing water quality management plans, which are also known as total maximum daily loads, for a number of the pollutants that are indicators of blue-green algae blooms. And we have, there's a number of management practices we work on with folks to do to reduce the potential hazards, but we're hoping to get a grant from EPA to help us do a statewide plan related to blue-green algae this year in 2010.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ray Gentle. I'm the Administrator for the Natural Resources Division, Oregon Department of Agriculture. Oregon Department of Agriculture's role related to blue-green algae is twofold. One of them is working with DEQ in regard to their water quality standards and the plans developed to address issues related to streams. We do not directly deal with the cyanotoxins or the bacteria, but we deal with the pollutants that may cause that problem through controlling erosion and maintaining water quality that way off of agricultural lands. We also play a role through our food safety program in that we have two aspects of that program. One of them is outreach, in which is keeping produce safe on the farms. We advise farmers on things they could do to have good quality products. And then the second area that we play a role is on Oregon shellfish along the coast. We monitor those shellfish for potential issues and help begin listing those when there are issues and when they can be raised. So those are the three programs that we have.
Thank you. Any questions for this panel? Okay. Thank you. I'm sure we'll be having further discussions about this, so stay tuned. Okay, next panel, we're going to have Brian Wegner, Alan Milligan, and Sue Marshall come up. And since we were running about 5 minutes, you have just about 15 minutes between the three of you with questions, so just want to make sure you time check. You want to start off, Brian?
Senator Dingfelder, I'm Brian Wegener from Tualatin River Keepers. Back in the summer of 2008, we had a cyanobacteria outbreak on the Tualatin River that was, we noticed it when we were having a canoe trip on the river, and U.S. Geological Survey was also sampling water at that same time, and they pointed out the problem to us. Their investigation traced the source of this problem back to discharge from Wapato Lake. Wapato Lake is a farm area that's drained each year for farming. And that year, the dike had broken in December, and so there was additional flooding. Tualatin Basin soils are high in phosphorus, which is a good stimulant for blue-green algae. In your documents that I provided you with is a four-page excerpt from Clean Water Services Flow Management Report that documents that investigation that USGS did, tracing it back to Wapato Lake. At the same time, the Joint Water Commission's drinking water plant was having what they call a taste and odor event, which they identified as jasmine is a chemical produced by blue-green algae, and they'd been having that event for about a month, but nobody was notified. DHS wasn't notified about that a month before, you know, we noticed the blue-green algae on the lower river. We wanted to indicate what the economic costs of this were. It cost the Joint Water Commission almost $300,000, and there's a document of that documents their costs there. Intel, is, we've heard, has had significant water treatment costs associated with this. Farmer Steve Dyke had crop damage associated with this, and his statement is in there. He estimates his economic loss to $300,000 from crop loss and talks about some health concerns that he had with himself. And downstream, there were the closure of a canoe and kayak rental business for 2 weeks, and the cost of Hillsborough Water District customers who purchased drinking bottled water for drinking water because of the bad taste from this outbreak. At this event, we identified some problems that we we are very concerned about. First of all, there's no requirement for public agencies to report outbreaks. We know that the Joint Water Commission knew about this problem, knew about a blue-green algae problem for a month before we discovered it. Clean Water Services also, their staff, their field people were out monitoring the river, and they noticed a floating mat of algae almost a week before we noticed it, but they didn't. There's no protocol for them to identify anybody. The reason anything got happened is largely due to U.S. Geological Survey recognizing the problem and calling everybody they knew, and 12th and Riverkeepers helping them with that effort. We called Washington County Public Health Department to see if they were going to close the parks, the public access points to the river, to keep people safe. They had no experience with that, said that we don't do that. And so I went out and did it myself. USGS called the local parks districts around there, the cities. One of them posted it, none of the others did. When the source was identified, we had this discharge from Wapato Lake, which had dead fish in it, low dissolved oxygen, obviously a pollutant source, visibly turbid water being put into the Tualatin River, but no agency had the authority to shut them down or took the authority to shut them down. Part of the problem why they did that is because it was discovered so late that this was the source, because they didn't know about it till, you know, a month after this had started. But Department of Agriculture just took no accountability in this. DEQ stepped up and did some testing. Because of the late date of it, it was hard for that to be, you know, the horse was out of the barn already, essentially. We also discovered, and Dr. Milligan will talk more about this, that cyanotoxin can be taken up by food crops, and Steve Dyke's statements there was he called agencies, Department of Agriculture, OSU Extension, trying to get advice on whether or not these crops should go to market. They did go to market, and Dr. Milligan will tell you some more about that issue. The health advisories that DHS issues are issued. They're put on a website. If you're on the mailing list or email list, you get that notification. But there's no local authority in the county health department or that's uniformly applies to notify the public that there's a problem going on here. Districts and areas where this is a recurrent problem, and Devil's Lake Water Improvement District is one that really has a very good program of notification, and they're on top of the problem and probably could serve as a model for other jurisdictions. But it takes DHS over a week, about 10 days, really, to issue the report, because they're relying on some tests, which Dr. Milligan will do that. And we need some early warning protocols too, to let the public know when these things are happening, and then we need some best management practices to prevent these things from happening. It's a lot of this has been traced to phosphorus or nitrogen nutrients being in the water that shouldn't be there and causing these blooms. So I think we need to develop some best management practices to prevent these things from happening.
Thank you, Brian. Go ahead, and please state your name for the record.
Senator Dingfelder, my name is Alan Milligan. I'm an assistant professor at Oregon State University in the Department of Plant Botany and Plant Pathology. I've been working on harmful algal blooms for 25 years, and I teach algal biology to undergraduates there. I want to cover just a few things right off the bat. The main way that we decide whether water is dangerous for cyanotoxins is by counting cyanobacteria that are potentially toxic. The diversity of cyanobacteria are such that many strains of the same species are not toxic, and many strains of the same species are very toxic. So we have this real disconnect between recognizing a cyanobacterial bloom that could be toxic or not. We don't measure the toxins. We only do the cell counts. That means that we could have water that is officially safe, that is dangerous for toxin load, and we could be defining water that is dangerous, that is completely safe. that's a big gap in our identification of this problem. I got involved with looking at this problem in plants through Oregon, through the agricultural extension at OSU. They had never had experience with cyanobacterial problems in crops, and when they asked me if that was a common problem, I said, no, it isn't, until I looked into literature that's only recently available. So we've only understood that cyanobacterial toxins get into crops for about 6 or 7 years now. And since that time, there's been extensive studies in laboratories. I want to stress that everything that I've given you in my write-up is only in laboratory work. It's realistic to the type of watering you do for a plant. For instance, they do overhead watering of the plants rather than pouring the water directly on the soil, things like that. But what these studies find is out of 11 crops that have been studied to date, significant amounts of toxin get into the plants. They inhibit photosynthesis, cell division, lateral root growth, basic fundamental developmental steps in plants, including flowering and fruiting. And Steve Dyke's experience, the grower that had damage to his crops, was that all of his black cap raspberries were both stunted in growth and they didn't flower. The few that did flower, fruit barely developed. And so that entire crop was not harvested for market. So that's his major damage. I was able to eventually get support through agricultural extension to run toxin tests on samples I took from sediments, soils on Steve Dyke's farm, and all of his crops. And fortunately, all of his crops that were harvested and went to market were tested negative for microcystins, so they were safe. The one that did test positive was a significant load, and that was for the black-cap raspberries, but because there was no fruit formed, those crops did not go to market. The unfortunate thing is that the plants are accumulating toxins to levels that are considered unsafe for consumption. In Oregon State, we do have a consumption limit for the algae that come out of Klamath Lake. Though that level is the same level that the World Health Organization has decided is the safe level. So in my little write-up here, I've given you a table that shows the amount of each of these 11 crops you could consume safely. And that level is disturbingly small amount of food. For instance, alfalfa sprouts, it's about 2 ounces of sprouts, or about as much as you put on your bagel, would put you right at the World Health Organization's limit for consumption of these toxins. In the case of Steve Dyke's crops, that would be about 3 or 4 ounces of raspberries, had the raspberries actually developed. So this is a significant potential exposure. The good news is that the plants that we know were probably exposed, beets, for instance, by the time I sampled them, which was probably about 3 to 4 weeks after they were exposed, there was no toxin left. So it looks like there is a significant turnover of the toxin, and the plants are getting rid of it. But there has been no laboratory studies to understand that sort of uptake rate and turnover and how long it takes to get it out of the plants. There's a lot of unknowns in this case. Let's see.
I'm going to have to ask you to wrap up because we just have about a minute left.
I can stop right there.
To Sue. Why don't you wrap up and then we'll see if there's some questions.
Great. Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, my name is Sue Marshall with Confluence Consulting. I'm here representing a number of organizations that are impacted by cyanobacteria. in addition to the Tualatin River Keepers, Dune City, Rogue River Keeper, Klamath River Keeper, and Oregon Environmental Council. I've compiled some letters from each of them. They describe the situations in their community. And just to touch very briefly on some of them, Oregon Environmental Council talks about cyanotaxin not easily fitting in existing regulatory boxes. Indeed, the Senate Bill 737 work, the broader toxin work that DEQ is doing, cyanotoxin isn't addressed in any of those. There's no drinking water or water quality standards for cyanotoxin, and because of its severe toxicity and what appears to be delays in testing to really understand that and notification, it poses a great problem. Mayor Hoffman of Dune City talks about they had outbreaks in 07 and 08. He describes their frustration in trying to figure out who to report this to, starting with Lane County and working through several agencies. And finally, when they got to the Department of Health, they basically told them that there was nothing they could do but advised us to put up signs that we would, and they would surely appreciate if the blooms tested and they could be provided with the results to the State Department. The Silcoos Lake provides recreation and is a drinking water source, and the city had to, at their expense, bring in fresh water to supply those people that depend on that. The mayor also notes delay in TMDL implementation, because ultimately I think we would all be interested in preventing these outbreaks and managing them to the best degree possible. Klamath River Keeper, the upper Klamath Lake is a concern. They've had chronic problems with outbreaks. There's been monitoring by USGS to look into liver toxin microcystin, which is a toxin that is produced. It is appearing in the fish. There is concern because this is a sustenance source of food for the local tribes. No public notices, no warnings have ever been posted at Upper Klamath Lake. And when I spoke with them, I think the schedule for TMDL development is out to 2020. Also, Rogue River Keeper, they have petitioned the state to list the water bodies that have chronic problems with cyanotoxins on the 303D list, and that should be a decision that comes out this year. To finalize, I would say all of these organizations participated in the meeting with the agencies. I'm very much appreciative to you, Chair Dingfelder, for participating and for the agency's time and attention to this issue. I believe we just scratched the surface, and we would like to continue. I think there are perhaps additional funds, maybe clarifications of authorities, but there's also education and I think a good deal of volunteer effort that could go towards this to support the efforts of the agencies, and we'd very much like to pursue that.
Thank you. Any questions for this panel? Senator Przonski?
Yeah. Is there a model to look at somewhere, some other state, some other country that's actually taken the steps that really has a framework that we could be at least looking at or using?
Can you pull the microphone? Yeah, thanks.
Yes, Senator Dingfelder. There is several models. Washington State, for instance, has a three-tiered warning system when they notice there's a problem, when they've determined there's toxin loads, and they actually close water bodies, which we do not do in Oregon. We only advise. Nebraska has an advanced system as well. Okay. There several states have.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay, thank you very much. Before you go, I just want to mention that we don't have a bill that I know of in the February special session, but I am going to ask the agencies to continue meeting with the stakeholder groups. I think this is something, obviously, that affects all of us. My view, it is the job of the agencies to protect public health and make sure that we're reducing the amount of these outbreaks, because they are on the rise. And if we do have outbreaks, to ensure that the information gets out in a timely manner to the public, so we're actually protecting public health. I know we have limited resources, but it's been done in other places. And what I'd like to see is we'll have probably not during February, but probably at the next interim meeting to give you some time to work on it. What I'd like to see is the maybe with DEQ as the lead coming back, working with your partner agencies at ODA and DHS with a proposal, sort of a work plan on how we're going to move forward with this. Hopefully, I'm not convinced yet that we need new legislation, but I need to see what is and what isn't working with existing legislation and a framework for how we can address this problem, make sure that we're looking at all the solutions on the table. I know that, certainly we need more research dollars, and that's something I know that you're interested in pursuing and working with USGS and some of the other agencies. But this is an issue that is growing. I was on the Rogue River late this summer when my guide said the reason she wasn't bringing her dog is she was not allowed to because there was actually some dog incidents where dogs were drinking water out of the Rogue and they were actually dying this summer. So the guiding agencies were told don't bring animals. It doesn't make you feel really good about swimming, obviously, when dogs are going in and then keeling over afterwards. So certainly we want to make sure that we're doing everything we can to protect public health and minimize this outbreak. So thank you all for your hard work in bringing this to the attention of this body, and look forward to working with you.
Thank you.
And I want to thank the agencies, too, for your work, and we'll look forward to hearing back from you. I'm going to ask Beth to see if we can put you on the agenda for the meeting following the February session, which will probably be sometime in May, is my understanding.
Yes.
Yeah. All right. Thank you very much. Next up, we have Mark Long and Patrick Allen. I don't know if Patrick's here. Okay. We're going to hear an update on Senate Bill 79, which passed last session. Beth, do you want to say a few words at all about Senate Bill 79, or we'll have Mark give the overview? You look all hesitant. Come on up.
Nobody wants to ever be first.
Okay, well, then I'll anoint you, Mark, because I know you were up in the hot seat all morning, so. Okay. We acknowledge
him. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Mark Long, Director of the Department of Energy. We're here to give you an overview of Senate Bill 79, and to my right, your left, is Jim Denno, who is one of the managers of the Department of Energy responsible for this program. So I'll have Jim kind of go over what we're doing. Overall, just to get the committee back reacquainted with the bill basically has three elements overall, having both DCBS and Department of Energy working in consultation with each other on establishing voluntary standards for energy performance scores, report to the legislature on a mandatory program, developing a REACH code, I believe, for in the building codes area, which is a voluntary code that would be above the mandatory code, and then bumping our building codes up by a percentage that's clarified within the bill. Do you want to have each department do an overview, or would you like? Okay. So on the performance score side, which the Energy Department is taking lead on, again, Jim Denno is here from the program area, and I'll have him just kind of quickly go over what he's been doing to date around implementing Section 1 of the bill.
Great. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Jim Denno, Manager of Building Technologies for the Department of Energy. What we've done to date with the task force is to assemble and meet. The task force, as outlined in the bill, is made up of 13 members from a variety of stakeholder groups throughout the state. And basically they have three tasks specified in the bill. The first is to study and evaluate energy use in buildings, both residential and commercial. Secondly, to develop recommendations for a voluntary energy performance scoring system for use in Oregon. And thirdly, to make a report to the legislature regarding the implementation of a mandatory statewide system. So that's the work that's been set out for the task force. We held the first meeting on January the 5th, and at this meeting the department provided a kind of overview of the subject matter, where the discussions went leading up to the bill that was passed in the 09 session, and then outlining the work plan for the group and some of the work also that's being done in other places. The work plan and timeline for the group is the next meeting is set for January the 26th. At this meeting, the group will be hearing presentations from invited speakers regarding energy use in buildings, commercial buildings, residential buildings. And then there will also be a presentation on a EPS system that has been piloted and is in use right now in the state of Oregon.
An EPS?
Sorry, Energy Performance Scoring System.
Because we have some students here that may not know all these acronyms. We want to make sure that...
Our members.
Our members.
Right. Well, you say it enough times and you look for shorthand. Yeah. Sorry. Then following that, we have a meeting scheduled for February, and at this meeting, we'll be hearing from folks at the national level who are involved in the discussions going on for the creation of a national energy performance scoring system. And we'll be hearing about the development of that system, what it might look like, what the timeline is. And also there are a whole variety of systems being used around the country and even in other countries right now. And so we're going to get a survey from someone at the national level about the various systems in use and their pros and cons and what might be appropriate for Oregon. So following that, in March and April, the group will focus on taking the information that they've gathered from these previous meetings and coming up with a recommendation for Department of Energy to use to adopt rules regarding a voluntary system. And what we're after is something that's consistent and has a set methodology that is useful for the public to use to make comparisons between the energy performance of buildings. So that will, as I say, result in rules which we will adopt by July 1st. Following that, subsequent meetings will focus on developing recommendations for the legislature regarding a possible statewide mandatory system. And those recommendations will be contained in a report to you all by October 1st. Now, if you're interested, you can follow the proceedings on our website. There's a link set there under our working groups area. And we'll be putting all the materials for the meetings and the resource materials on that website.
Okay.
Questions?
I think we're going to hear from Pat, and then we'll open it up.
Sure.
Thank you for the update. And I'll probably want to have you update us possibly in the May meeting, because it sounds like that might be a good time to come back and report after some of those initial meetings.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Patrick Allen. I'm the Acting Administrator of the Building Codes Division at the Department of Consumer and Business Services. We were given four charges in Senate Bill 79. First, to immediately increase energy efficiency in commercial structures by 15 to 25%, actually by January 2012. By the same date, to increase energy efficiency in residential structures by 10 to 15%. To develop the REACH or aspirational code that Mr. Long talked about, a code that's separate from the statewide mandatory building code, but that allows for a sort of a standardized voluntary approach to optional standards, emerging technologies, materials, and those sorts of things. We're then basically supposed to set out on a course of identifying a continuous improvement system for energy efficiency in all structures, aiming toward targets along the lines of net zero or buildings that don't use any net energy by 2030. It's a fairly aggressive goal. The idea is, as we go through our periodic code cycle, you may or may not know, we update each of these codes every 3 years or so. And as we do that update, we're supposed to look to the REACH code to figure out, are there things that we have tried in that code that now can be mainstream mandatory techniques, move them into the base code, and then look to reach the REACH code further, if you will. In terms of progress, we are about to propose the commercial code to the Building Code Structures Board. Coming up in its meetings in February, they'll go through a public hearing process on that code. Well, the proposal they'll be receiving has gone through an extensive code committee and other public outreach process to get to the package of code changes that we'll be looking at there. I would love to tell you there's some whiz-bang, sexy, really interesting thing that's going to be there that you'll read about in all the papers, but it's really boring stuff like the efficiency of windows, amounts of insulation, the efficiency of heating, ventilation, and air conditioning equipment, how much window space is there. Windows are kind of interesting because they let light in, which is good, but they also let heat out, which is bad. It's a bunch of that, those sorts of things. That code will move forward, we hope, through that process. We'll then begin working on the changes to the residential code, which currently is scheduled for adoption about a year from now. Once we've got the base set, particularly in the commercial code, we'll begin work on what the REACH code looks like. We really kind of needed to know what the baseline standard is before we could begin figuring out what the REACH beyond that is. And that's where we sit with that bill right now.
Great. Thank you, Patrick. I know you've been very busy, and appreciate your leadership on this and making sure it moves forward. I know we gave you a lot to do last session. So any questions? Yeah, actually I have one. I can let you guys get off that easy. My understanding, and I don't know if this is still the statistic, but I heard that we're tied as fourth in the nation as far as energy efficiency, you know, as far as having programs that make us the fourth most energy efficient state in the nation, and that we're tied fourth. So, and my understanding is California is number one, and it's going to be probably hard to beat them, but what is it going to take for us to move up to, let's just say, number two? I mean, when we adopt the REACH code and have some of these other proposals that you're talking about actually adopted the rules, is that going to move us up the ladder? What is it that makes us number four versus number two?
Yeah, I've looked into that issue a little bit, and based on what I looked at, it looked like the biggest drivers for the states ahead of us were their energy portfolio standards. Mm-hmm. And so really large-scale decisions about sources of energy generation overall seemed to be the factors that were causing the largest gap between us and the states immediately ahead of us. These kinds of changes will make meaningful differences in our energy usage, but they're probably not the kinds of things that in and of themselves would cause us to, you know, move up to number one, number two, that sort of thing, if that's what we're looking for. Mark can probably add to that.
I'm sure. Mark Long. I think on the code side, and the code administration implementation enforcement, which is a scoring mechanism that rolled up into that number four, we were awfully high, if I recall. Mm-hmm. So I know Patrick is going to raise the state up even higher, but we're getting right up against the threshold. And I don't want to digress here. One of the challenges, as he gets the codes to a robust nature, doesn't leave a lot of room for me for incentives above that. And so we're working out those issues as well. So I don't know what it's going to do for our overall score, as Pat mentioned, but you just need to know on the building code side, we scored awfully high, and I think we're above even the states, so we're above us on that individual area.
Okay. Great. Well, I appreciate that. I know that many other states look to us as a model, but certainly there's always room for improvement, but I'm glad we're continuing to reach for that higher goal. So with that, we'll probably be hearing from you again probably this spring with updates, and I'm sure Beth will be filling you in on what the dates are. So thank you, gentlemen, for coming in today.
Thank you.
And before we have our next panel, I want to welcome, we have students, I believe, are you from the Arbor School, from Representative Cannon's school? So you're all in Representative Cannon's class. So you got to see him in action today. Did you ask him some tough questions? Put him on the spot. Okay. So you're here for the day?
Yeah.
Well, welcome. It's really great having you here. And as you can tell, we're just hearing a lot of really boring information, but glad you could join us. I don't know if Gail Achterman and John Van Lanningham. Okay, so is Will Collin here? Will, why don't you come on up? We're going to jump ahead a little bit because the presenters for the Metropolitan Planning Organization, they're just finishing up in Representative Cannon's committee. Is that right at the same time? Oh, transportation. So, Brenda isn't here yet. So we're going to hear an update from the chair of the Environmental Justice Task Force that was created in 2007, is that correct?
That's correct.
Yes. And appreciate you coming here today, and thank you for your hard work. Yes, and for being here early.
Always ready.
Yes.
Well, Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for your time and attention. You will be getting the testimony for today that refreshes your recollection on our background of Senate Bill 420. I talked with the sponsor of the bill a couple hours ago, Senator Abel Gordley, who sends her warm regards to everyone.
And can you just state your name for the record?
Will Collin, Chair of the Environmental Justice Task Force, created by Senate Bill 420. And as the requirements are before you, we have some statutory duties. And I've submitted as written testimony the law review article I've written on the topic for Lewis and Clark that will be in PDF file. If people have trouble sleeping at night, I'm sure it will help you on it. But it can go into more of the details here. And our duties are to advise the governor on environmental justice issues. We have 18 natural resource agencies that we work closely with in a collaborative way to prevent downside risk of environmental justice liability. That's the first thing we've been trying to do. And we've had a good relationship with all the agencies, who are sometimes small, bewildered state agencies who are wondering why they're there, like Department of State Lands. And we talk with them, and I'll get into what we're doing with that. The agencies named in the Act have duties to us. They're not requests. They're duties, and they're statutory. And it's to consider environmental justice implications of their actions, to engage in public outreach activities in impacted communities, to hold hearings at times and places convenient for those impacted. The money item you need to think about, but I'm not advocating one way or another here, but says in the statute, is to create a citizen advocate position for each of those agencies. And then the directors of each agency has to report to us and the governor on a variety of issues. And I've been through this before with a prior governor, Governor Kitzhaber, and so I have experience with this. And we wanted to proceed in a collaborative way with the agencies, and we've had nothing but good experiences. And I'm proud of how Oregon has stood nationally on environmental justice, when just north of us there's a Federal Circuit Court of Appeals decision called Rosemere holding EPA's feet to the fire in the state of Washington. So we are heads and shoulders above other state agencies. And here's what we've been doing this year. We've had quorum at every meeting. Every meeting we've had quorum. And we're a voluntary state agency with people coming long distances. The first project we're working on is community mapping. And this is in an early stage of development. We're relating demography, race, income, to environmentally regulated areas. Ultimately, to relay environmental risk or hazard to human vulnerability, just to provide more information to state agencies. What they do with it in terms of permits and licensure and authorization is up to them. We can't inform that. We can only inform that. We can't decide it. And we're making some good progress with that, and there's some money from the EPA for that, and there's some nonprofit groups working, OPEL, a group working with that, and Department of Environmental Quality has given us great work with that. Secondly, what we've done is to increase cultural competency in the state agencies by having natural resource agencies having to know what EJ is. Mm-hmm. Simple. Persuade people as a position description that this is what it is, and this is how we need to work with it professionally. And we've had a lot of energy on that in my task force. The third big use of our time is these customized agency environmental task force plans. And these agencies are struggling, and this is a very controversial issue. I've written the only book on controversial environmental issues. So what we try to do is meet quietly and softly with the agencies to see what their needs are and how we can work with them and what we spot in terms of our own expertise on the committee. And we're about one-third of the way through that, and that should be part of our annual report that comes out at the end of this month. Another document you got that we created was a Your Voice document that's on the webpage, and just what voices people have about the decisions that affect them, and to increase the capacity of our communities to engage in environmental decisions, all communities, rural, urban, all communities. We danced with the issue of field burning, but not in the way you usually get to. What we said is that the field burning rules that affect the 9 Willamette counties should be the same rules that affect all counties, equal application of environmental regulation. We didn't touch with the strict regulation that occurs in Willamette Valley, and I'm on some of those advisory committees, so I'm very well aware of what's going on with that. But we just said that it should be the same. We had a lot of public testimony on Columbia River Crossing. Let's just say there was a breakdown in environmental justice communications, but It appears that Washington Department of Transportation rules and consideration of environmental justice preempts ODOT's. And it's continuing. I don't know where it's going to go, but we get a lot of testimony on it. The interface with the new Oregon Health Agency, we think we can proceed informally with that, and that's going along very well. Lastly, the economic stimulus concerned us a little bit because it was shovel-ready only, and some of our communities weren't shovel-ready. So MBEs, which is minority business enterprises and women business enterprises that have to compete with majority enterprises, weren't ready to go. Some projects weren't really for the communities that were impacted. So community mapping, looking at customized environmental justice plans, giving your voice as a website. We've set the groundwork for capacity, and we're having a public outreach event March 10th at Portland State University with now Professor Abel Gordley. So you know there's a life after your job here. She's going to be there. Everyone's going to be there, and it's to be very inclusive of Portland City Club, of groups that don't usually come to environmental justice events, but we are, if anything, we are very inclusive of industry, community, and local government in particular.
Thank you.
Any questions, concerns,
see if there's
or comments?
Questions? Mm-hmm. I have one regarding fees, and I don't know if this is something that you track, because, for instance, I'm sure you know that we raised quite a bit of fees last session, and there are not necessarily based on ability to pay.
Right.
So when it comes to, for instance, park fees, and, you know, the concern that I have is making sure that we're not blocking access for especially low-income Oregonians to visit our natural areas. So I don't know if you've at all participated in when there's hearings about fees or making sure that the agencies think about that as they're looking at fee increases.
We've looked at and land use appeal fees in terms of appealing LUBA fees and how that can be exclusive of someone trying, a property owner trying to have a right to go forward with what they want to appeal. Park fees, we haven't looked at. We're waiting to work with the agency involved with that. But we will now make it a matter of concern. A big issue that's come up, and agencies are all over, and fees affect agencies differently too. So these agencies that have interrelationships on charges get hard for my task force to understand. But emergency response issues along the coast is a huge issue for disabilities, for any vulnerability. And so, you know, that's across so many agencies, we don't know how to get our hands around that. So the fee issue has been that kind of issue with us, that it crosses so many groups that we're trying to prioritize do sort of triage with it. But we haven't had any feedback on exclusion. There's national park data, I know, from my research in environmental justice that has exclusion numbers on that. But the fee data, we don't have numbers on, but I will ask.
Thank you. And I just want to thank you for your leadership and your hard work on this task force, because we know that we've asked you to, it's a big charge, and obviously you've been very, very busy over the past year and a half. We appreciate your hard work. Can you please make sure that I would certainly like to extend an invitation to all the members of the committee to attend this event. I know it's in the Portland area on March 10th, but if you can send the information, committee staff will make sure that we get that out.
Definitely. And I think we have a lot to be proud of. Other states, it's an uphill battle that's intractable issues. Here, we're starting with a fresher slate and really can make good decisions. So I will follow up on the fees issue particularly.
Great. Thank you. And I certainly want to extend our thanks to my former Senator Abel Gordley, who was my senator. So certainly I give her our regards, and I'll make sure and let her know that we're keeping her legacy continuing here. And thank you again for all that you've done to make sure that we get this up and going on the right foot.
Thank you, Madam Senator.
Okay. And I was going to thank you. I was going to give Gail and John a break. If you guys are, yes, he's shaking his head. So we were going to have Brenda from just give a brief update on the integrated resource management strategy that let you guys catch your breath a little bit, and then we'll hear about the Metropolitan Planning Task Force. So Brenda Bateman is going to provide an update on the integrated water resource management strategy. You know that, and I think Christina's coming back, and it looks like Ray, but you guys are, I'm not giving you more time.
Okay.
So you have to divide your time up. I think my colleagues are well aware of the integrated strategy, so maybe you can just provide an update, and I know that there's a big policy meeting coming up, so maybe you can talk about that. Okay, Brenda, you can kick it off.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe we'll have PowerPoint in a moment, or maybe not. Either way is fine. Greetings to the committee members. For the record, my name is Brenda Bateman with the Water Resources Department, and I'm joined this afternoon by my project team colleagues, Christine Svetkovich from DEQ and Ray Dandel from Department of Agriculture. There's a fourth member of our project team from Fish and Wildlife, Bruce McIntosh, who's not here with us this afternoon, but the four of us are the senior staff working together on this project. And we wanted to take just a few minutes this afternoon to update you on the work that we've been doing on the integrated water resources strategy. This came formally out of House Bill 3369 from the last session, although of course the agencies had been building a foundation and working on a long-term planning a bit before that even. Just wanted to remind you that the bill itself directs the Water Resources Department to lead these efforts, but to do so in close partnership with DEQ, ODF&W, and Department of Agriculture, as well as other state agencies, tribes, stakeholders, and partners throughout Oregon. The strategy at its core has a very simple goal, I think, and that is to better understand and to meet the water resource needs of Oregon, both today and tomorrow. And when we talk about needs, we're talking not just water quantity, but also water quality and ecological needs as well. And so by looking at all of those at the same time, that's what makes it integrated. And really, I think, is a departure from what we've done before in terms of our planning, and is quite a bit different from where many states have at least started their planning efforts, although I will say that most states that are doing planning are moving in that direction as you need to in this day and age. So the strategy is the text of the House bill also calls for us to look at some of the coming pressures, particularly climate change, but the bill also talks about population growth and land use change. So those are some of the technical pieces that we'll be considering as we move through this project. You may recall some of the benchmarks were to report back formally to the legislature in 2011 to talk about our progress in this area, and then the first rendition of this strategy would be due in 2012 with five-year updates thereafter. So this is a long-term plan, and we've spent much of our time in the last few months putting together the institutional capacity and a lot of the structure for this project. If we could talk just a little bit about where we've spent phase one. The last few months of the year were spent putting together some background papers or issue papers, which we released for public comment, got many comments, hundreds of comments actually on these. They were very helpful to us in our process, using a lot of maps, data sets, and things that we already have at the agencies, but to putting them together in one place for the first time. And these chapters are meant to spell out why we should care, why we should be planning at all for water at this time. And some of the solutions or water resource opportunities that we have if we conduct a planning exercise. So in phase one, we were working on those papers. We plan to release a second version of those papers here shortly, although many of the comments asked us to add quite a bit of information, which is taking time. So there's a new section in there on public health and drinking water. There's a new section on land use, water interface, and a new section on federal reservoirs and storage systems. So that's quite a bit of extra writing. It'll take us a little bit to turn those around. We hope to have the papers out again the first half of this year. Also in phase one of this project, we've been developing some of our institutional capacity, our advisory groups, for instance. We have an advisory group that's a policy advisory group made of 18 citizen members. These folks will be meeting for the first time next Tuesday at ODF&W. And the composition of this group is very diverse geographically and in terms of their interests. There are water users, conservation groups, other water advocates. It's a really nicely balanced group of thoughtful folks who are going to serve as an advisory group, a ground truthing group, to help us vet some of our ideas and move forward. The final outcome of this project is really going to be a set of recommended actions. This is an action plan for the the next 5 years. And so this group's main responsibility will be helping us to prioritize some of the things we're hearing and create a set of action plans as we come out of this project. In addition to the policy advisory group, though, we have a great set of colleagues that we've been able to call on for help and get us the technical and data-related pieces that we need for this project. There's an agency advisory group made up of our four departments plus the other natural resource and economic development agencies in Oregon and some of the task forces and committees out of the governor's office. So these folks met together for the first time in December and are really helping to put together the technical agenda that we'll bring to a policy advisory group for prioritization and further discussion.
I was going to say, we may just skip the presentation. I think Brenda's doing pretty well on her own.
Thank you.
We just may need to turn the lights on because I think I hear some snoring in the back row.
Thank you, Rich. No, that's okay. Thank you. As we move into the year 2010, we're into phase two of the project, which is now more of the information gathering and vetting with communities, stakeholders, and partners. And so you'll start to hear more information coming from us about workshops that we're offering for stakeholder associations, their boards and committees as we move through the year, but also a set of open houses that we're planning in Oregon communities late spring and summer. And what we're doing there is really building on the work that came from the OSU roundtables that were held in about half a dozen Oregon communities in the fall of 2008. A lot of information was gathered there, so that's where we're going to start. We're going to show folks this information, make sure it still resonates with them, and then collect some more. We have some additional questions on top of that. We want to make sure that we're hearing from folks and that they're hearing about the project. And the other reason that we're holding these open houses is to showcase some local projects that have already shown successes and that we might use as models so we can replicate them in other Oregon communities. There is a list in the work plan that's been distributed to you, and I've hit most of those highlights in my presentation today. But near the back, you'll see in our public involvement plan a list of dates for these open houses. I'll caution you that those have already changed as some of our venues and access to those venues have changed. So if you're interested in participating, and I would caution everyone who's listening today to please check the project website for updated venues and times as we get further into the spring. But we've outlined about 10 communities that we'll be visiting this spring and summer to showcase projects and get information and provide information. So we're looking forward to meeting up with communities in those venues. I think that concludes my presentation this afternoon. I'll be happy to take any questions.
And are you two here to answer questions as well? Okay. See if there's any questions.
It was fabulous. Great.
Okay. I actually just have one comment because I did at 6 a.m. this morning get to read the draft before my 8 a.m. Judiciary Committee hearing. The one comment I would make just on page 4, it seems like we need some fleshing out of the goals as far as, I know you talked about sort of the long-term strategy, and I don't know if that's something that you're going to finalize with the policy group, but that was the part that I get the understanding our existing problems, but we need to know what's the roadmap and how we're going to get there. And
that's right, Madam Chair, and that was one part that I skipped that I was actually hoping to have up on the screen with the slide. But we have outlined, gone back through the statute or through the bill from last session to make sure that we have captured and that we plan to address all of the pieces that we were asked to as part of House Bill 3369. And working with our commission, actually, they've put together a vision for this project that was done pretty early on, and then we filled in some of the meat from there, the goals and objectives. And what we'd like to do then as part of this project and with our advisory groups is to fill in yet more detail in recommended actions even underneath each of those objectives. So we have quite a bit of work ahead of us, but this is the beginning of that roadmap and how our work will be organized.
All right. Thank you. Thank you all for your hard work. I look forward to hearing the updates. And okay, without any questions, thanks. And thanks for being flexible with the schedule here.
Thank you.
And I'll look forward to hearing about the meeting on the 19th. Good luck with that.
Will do.
Oh, okay. All right, next up, we're going to hear an update on the Metropolitan Planning Organization Greenhouse Gas Emissions Task Force, which I served on. I'm not even going to begin to use the acronym for that. And appreciate, I know Gail and John, you're sort of on the circuit today. So appreciate coming here today. And I just want to let folks know, right after this, we're going to take a short break just to let folks get a drink of water and stretch their legs, and then we'll finish the rest of the agenda. So with that, Gail and John, take it away.
Chair Dingfelder, thank you for having us meet with you this afternoon. I'm Gail Achterman, the chair of the Oregon Transportation Commission and co-chair of the Metropolitan Planning Organization Greenhouse Gas Emission Task Force.
I'm John Van Lanningham. I'm the chair of the Land Conservation and Development Commission. I work as a legal aid lawyer in Eugene. We intend to be brief. We've given you a 40-page report from the task force, as well as a several-page-long summary. We're not going to read that. We hope to leave time for questions. We're going to tag team this, which is how we co-chaired the task force. And we want to acknowledge the work of Senator Dingfelder on the task force, as well as Representatives Call and Terry Beyer.
With that, I think I'll start by providing a little bit of background on why should we care about greenhouse gas emissions from the transportation sector, and what role do metropolitan planning organizations have to play. The 2009 legislature formed the task force to really develop a process for adopting and implementing plans to reduce greenhouse gas emissions from the transportation sector. And it's important to note, just as a basic piece of information, that 34% of greenhouse gas emissions in the state of Oregon are attributable to the transportation sector. So if we have any expectation of meeting our statewide statutory greenhouse gas emission reduction goals, we're going to have to figure out how to reduce emissions in this sector. Most of the greenhouse gas emissions are in the metropolitan areas of the state, and there are six metropolitan areas that are designated under federal law as metropolitan, that have metropolitan planning organizations. These are Portland, Vancouver, that's the whole Portland metropolitan area, Salem, Kaiser, Eugene, Springfield, Medford, Bend, and Corvallis. And I think we ought to be very clear here that the bulk of the emissions are actually all in the Willamette Valley. So Medford and Bend are in kind of a different category in terms of where the emissions come from. They do have emissions, but the bulk are in the Willamette Valley. The state, through the Department of Transportation and the Land Conservation and Development Department, are responsible for providing the overall transportation and land use framework for metropolitan planning, but the actual work of doing the metropolitan planning is carried out, at least in terms of transportation, by the metropolitan planning organizations. Five of the six are truly creatures of federal law, not state law. The Portland metro area actually has an elected metropolitan government, which is chartered under state statute. The other five exist because under the Federal Surface Transportation Act, any community of 50,000 people or more it has to set up a metropolitan planning organization of the cities and the counties and the state transportation agency to do regional transportation planning. And if you look at the table on page 3 of our testimony, it's important to note how much the MPOs vary in size, budget, and authority from Bend, which gets $223,000 a year to support their planning efforts, and that's federal funds, and a very small amount of state funds, and they've got 2.5 staff people, versus Portland Metro, which has $10,993,000 a year to do planning, and has a staff of 96 people. So we've got very different capacity among the six metropolitan planning organizations, and yet these are the vital body for cooperative transportation decision making, five of them really being city and county government officials, elected officials who are serving on these organizations. John?
So I'm going to talk about the process that we use to make a decision and then talk about scenario planning and impediments. We met four times between October 15th and December 4th. The meetings were well attended. All six MPOs had representatives. They all came, and they came with staff. We had a lot of observers. We had a smaller subset of us that edited documents that staff drafted. That subgroup was me and Gail, Craig Campbell from AAA, Mary Kyle McCurdy from 1,000 Friends, and then representatives from three of four of the six MPOs, Metro, Eugene, Salem, and Corvallis, Albany. So that work group did the sort of word-by-word, line-by-line editing, and the whole task force looked at the final document. At the beginning of the process, we agreed that we would act only by consensus minus one. So two members could block. In my way of thinking, that meant that two MPOs could block because the MPOs share, especially the five non-metro MPOs, share a lot of the same concerns. We did reach agreement, consensus, on December 4th at our last meeting. So this document comes to you with consensus agreement from the task force members. That does not mean that there are not still concerns, because a lot of what we've done here is lay out a framework for going forward and not making the hard decisions. At our prior hearing, we had Senator George asking questions about whether we were going to take away his pickup truck. And the answer is that that's not this report. That may be the next report. Who knows? But that's not what this report is about. This report is about how we're going to help the MPOs plan to address this stuff. And how they're going to do it in a significant part is through something called scenario planning. It's a fancy term for just considering how land use developments and transportation alternatives might be done in various ways and what the outcomes would be in comparing those outcomes. We do that to some extent already with our land use planning and our transportation planning, but now we're talking about doing more of it with more alternatives, more information, and more evaluation. It's something that's very popular nationally, sort of a trend nationally. We believe that there will be federal funding for it nationally. We believe that this report and the recommendations of this report will put us in a good position to compete for federal funding. We have had some concerns by MPOs that doing scenario planning is a long-term process. That's true. Plans take a time to develop. We think that bringing along the public or educating the public about the issues is a key element of this, and that's not going to happen quickly. But this is a problem that's not going to go away quickly, and so the fact that this work will take some time doesn't mean that we shouldn't do it. We had agreement from the MPOs without our bidding that this is a significant problem that they are committed to doing something about and that they think they can do something about. At the same time, they were quick to remind us that they have, as Gail noted, little authority to do anything with regard to land use planning, and five of the six have no resources. So we're trying to balance those two things, a recognition of the need to do something versus the limited ability to do something. Medford, of course, was quick to remind us of those same issues. We think that the report has a lot more than just scenario planning, and Gail's going to talk about some of those things later.
I think that the recommendations, the legislature in 2009 asked this group to develop recommendations for the February session and then ultimately for the 2011 session. And so the report contains the detailed recommendations. They haven't been written up yet into a legislative concept. But some of the principles that the task force agreed on in moving forward are that figuring out plans for how to reduce GHG emissions from the transportation sector is going to require a lot of flexibility because these five MPOs are really different, and local governments have different attitudes and different approaches, and we've got to recognize that. We've got to build on and coordinate with other ongoing planning efforts. The Jobs and Transportation Act has already directed the metro area in Portland and the Eugene-Springfield area to do scenario planning and to have that scenario planning done within the next 2 years, certainly by 2012. And so they're like the lead players and are going to be able to test it, and we need to make any recommendations coming out of this task force fit with the work that's ongoing under House Bill 2001. And we also need to recognize that while the recommended legislation for the February session isn't going to have any funding implications, we're not really going to be able to take on this task. The state agencies, ODOT and LCDC, or the MPOs and local governments without additional funding, because there isn't funding available to do this right now. So the recommendations of the task force are to really do three things. One is for ODOT to develop a framework that for reducing GHG emissions, so that you can see how state actions, metropolitan regional actions, and local actions all fit together, and so that everybody can see what doing their part means within a broader context instead of acting in isolation. Second, under House Bill 2001, DLCD is going to, the commission actually is going to set targets allocating transportation sector GHG emissions to the various MPOs. And so that's another critical benchmark moving forward. And third is that, and this is something that there was widespread support, there was consensus on the entire set of recommendations, but the local governments, cities and counties, and MPOs are all very interested in technical assistance from DLCD and ODOT in order so they could have basically a detailed toolkit that helps them understand what are the tools they have available as local governments to reduce GHG emissions in the transportation sector. And so those three elements, the framework, the targets, the toolkit, and then we'll deploy those over three phases. One is that over the next 2 years before the 2011 session, using existing resources, the MPOs and the state agencies would be, this, particularly the MPOs, using existing resources would begin to explore what they can do to reduce GHG emissions, particularly as they work on their regional transportation plans, which they're obligated to do under federal law. The second phase begins in 2012 and really is contingent on the state targets being set, adequate financial resources being available, and the state guidance or toolkits being available. And at that point, the MPOs would develop land use and transportation scenario plans, leading into phase three, where those scenario plans would be integrated into the federally required regional transportation plans. John?
A couple of other recommendations in the report. Gail mentioned already, I think, or I mentioned that we want to fund during this current biennium without new funding from you, but with existing funding, a pilot project of scenario planning with the Central Lane MPO. HB 2001 requires Central Lane to do this. They don't have the funding to do it. So we heard loud and clear from the MPOs a concern about how scenario planning works, whether it's worth the effort. This will give us a chance to test that out. Other recommendations include coming back to you in the 2011 and 2013 sessions to report on how these things are doing. We're building in evaluation requirements. The concept is that local governments and the state would be trying these ideas, and then we would be evaluating as we go along. Are they working? Are there other tools that we could use that would work better? So evaluation is a big part of what we're talking about here. We don't think we know all the answers, obviously, at this point. The other recommendation is that some group needs to continue to do some work here, whether that's this task force or some other group or some subset of the task force is up to you all in the special session. But some work needs to be continued in terms of developing the funding concepts further so that in the 2011 session we can come back and talk about what it would mean to adequately fund the MPOs to do the planning and to do the implementation that Gail talked about for Phase 2 and then later in Phase 3. There are also issues that need to be addressed in terms of authority. I mentioned those earlier. The state's authority, which is not clear, over the MPOs, whether there should be any state authority over the MPOs. The MPO authority at the local level to do anything, whether they should have that authority. Metro does. The other five do not. I would hazard a guess that the other five do not want authority to do land use planning. But we're going to have to figure out a way to implement whatever we conclude with that scenario planning. I think that's our report.
Okay, great. See if there's any questions. I think we're going to let you off easy.
Great.
Sounds like you got grilled in transportation, so we're the kindler, gentler committee. But I wanted to thank both of you for your leadership, having served on that. I think we accomplished a great amount in four meetings, but certainly you two at the helm helped a lot in shaping this report, and certainly we'll look forward to the legislation when it comes out, and hopefully it's got to be soon because we're meeting again in about a couple weeks. But wanted to also thank the agencies and there were some other task force members that are in the room, because we spent quite a few hours drafting this, but certainly your leadership on this, I think, helped it go a lot smoother. So I look forward to working with you in February.
Thank you. And thank you, Senator, for your participation in the group.
Okay. We actually are going to take a break because our next speakers are not up till 2:45, and since we're going till about 4:15 or so today, we're going to take a 15-minute break. We're going to start...
10 minutes.
You can leave early if you want. We're going to start promptly at 2:45. With that... We will unrecess. This is a Senate Interim Committee on Environment and Natural Resources, and I'm going to call up our next panel. It's going to talk about bisphenol A. And just a reminder, you have 45 minutes. I'll ask you to end a little bit early so we can take time for questions. And I apologize if I'm not saying your names right. Steve, is it Henges? William Hoyle and Carolyn Silveira. And just a reminder, if you have a testimony, you can hand it to Sue and she'll pass it out. And then just please state your name for the record. Welcome. Welcome to Oregon. I heard some of you from out of state. I know you came here just specifically for the weather today, so we made it special for you.
Well,
I wanted you to see the true Oregon. So you wouldn't go back and tell your friends that it's wonderful and sunny here and you want to move here. Whoever wants to go first, yep.
Thank you, Senator Dingfelder, and the members of the committee that will, I guess, come momentarily.
Yep, they heard their names. There's one.
There they come. So thank you for this opportunity to come and talk with you about bisphenol A. I'm Dr. Steve Henches, and what I do is I manage a group called the Polycarbonate BPA Global Group, which consists of the global manufacturers of BPA, bisphenol A, and polycarbonate plastic. And what we do is we sponsor quite a bit of research on BPA, health and environmental research. We advocate based on the science, like today, and otherwise communicate also generally based on the science. And so I've been involved, deeply involved in the science on BPA for about almost exactly 10 years now. And most of what I talk about today will really be from that perspective. But what I want to do first is start off with just a few pieces of basic information about bisphenol A, just along the lines of what is it. So bisphenol A is a chemical that is primarily used to make two things, polycarbonate plastic and epoxy resins. Important to know, I think, is that these are not new materials. They've all been safely used now for about 50 years or more, and you'll find them today in a very wide array of common consumer products. So you probably know that there are many different plastics on the market, all sorts of different products that are made out of plastics, and all of these different plastics, they each have their own unique set of attributes or properties that, and it is those properties that make each plastic useful in some products, some applications, but not so useful in others. So they're different. So what is it about polycarbonate and epoxy resins that make them so useful today? Well, polycarbonate is a clear, very highly shatter-resistant material, and it's used in common consumer products such as eyeglass lenses, shatter-resistant eyeglass lenses, sports safety equipment, things like bicycle helmets, football helmets, CDs and DVDs, as well as in some reusable bottles and food storage containers. Epoxy resins, on the other hand, are quite different materials. These are very durable, chemically resistant materials. They have good adhesion, and that combination of attributes makes them very useful as protective coatings. Usually that means on a metal surface. And you'll find them in products such as the laminate for printed circuit boards, corrosion-resistant coatings for pipes and structural steel, the primer coating on automobile bodies, and the protective coating on most food and beverage cans. And you'll hear much more about that in particular from Dr. Hoyle, who I think will be speaking right after me. Another important piece of information is that for both polycarbonate and epoxy resins, there are only traces of BPA that remain in these materials. The BPA has been chemically reacted to make the plastic or the resin, so there are only traces of BPA left in these materials, typically about 50 parts per million or less. So only very, very small levels. And what that means is that consumers using products made from polycarbonate or epoxy resin, there really isn't any significant level of BPA that they can be exposed to. There are no products today that would have any higher levels of BPA beyond those PPM levels. As I mentioned, these materials have been safely used for more than 50 years, and over that time, in particular over the last 10 or 12 years or so, BPA has become one of the best tested of all substances in commerce. You will find few chemicals of any type that have more test data, more science, more research that has been done on any other chemical. So what that means for the subject at hand today is that we have an extraordinarily rich scientific database to evaluate the safety of BPA. And when I say extraordinarily rich, literally there are hundreds, many, I don't know how many, I couldn't really put a number on it, probably thousands of studies that have been conducted on BPA. These are studies of all different types. They're not certainly not all equal, but there are at least hundreds and perhaps thousands of studies that are relevant for assessing the safety of BPA. In the time we've got today, I'm not going to be going through those hundreds and thousands of studies, and I assume you'll probably appreciate that I won't even try. We can do that later, though, if you wish. Be happy to do that.
I've read most of them, so it's okay. You don't have to.
She read it for me.
Whether you read them or not, you've certainly heard about some of them in other hearings or reading the newspapers and on the Internet. You've certainly heard about some of these studies, probably not all of them. But what is probably more important for you to know is that all of that science, those many hundreds of studies or whatever the number is, those studies have been comprehensively reviewed by quite a few government bodies around the world, in particular in the last couple of years. And the status today is that based on the weight of scientific evidence, based on all these many hundreds of studies, the consensus amongst regulatory bodies around the world, and this is from U.S. to Canada to Europe and Japan and most recently down to Australia and New Zealand, is that BPA isn't a risk to human health, and that includes the health of infants and children. And those are the population group that we most care about, and those are the products used by infants and children that typically are the ones that we're most interested in. And this is particularly true at the extremely low levels of BPA that people could be exposed to from use of products made from polycarbonate plastic or epoxy resins. Perhaps most notable are the views of the government bodies in Europe, and the reason I say most notable is that you might be familiar with something called the precautionary principle, which has been adopted into law in Europe. And put simply, if you haven't heard of it, what it really comes down to is better safe than sorry. So the sort of thing you learn as a child, better safe than sorry. It's very common sense. And that has actually, in a little bit more elaborate form, of course, has been adopted into law in Europe. But so that's why I think the situation in Europe is particularly interesting, because what's happened there is that after review of the science on BPA more than once, but multiple times, after review of the science and then application of the precautionary principle, which is required, the government bodies in Europe have found no reason to take any action on BPA. There are no bans or restrictions in place in Europe at all on BPA. And in fact, in Europe, products made from polycarbonate plastic or epoxy resin, and this includes things like baby bottles and sippy cups and canned infant formula, these products are accepted as safe for use, and they are widely used in Europe. So within the last year or so, maybe a couple of years, we've seen new or updated safety assessments from the European Food Safety Authority, which is kind of like FDA in Europe, not exactly, but it's would be like a part of FDA, from the European Union. And we've also seen supporting statements or reports from agencies such as the French Food Safety Authority, the German Federal Institute for Risk Assessment, the Danish Environmental Protection Agency, and then most recently in Europe from the Swiss health authorities. And dropping down to Australia and New Zealand just momentarily, just a few days ago, I think it was the 10th or 11th of January, just within the last week, the Australian and New Zealand Food Safety Authorities, they work together in a single agency, they issued a joint statement expressing their concurrence with the views of these many other government bodies worldwide regarding the safety of BPA. I also want to mention Canada, because that's been something you probably heard about. And in Canada, an assessment of BPA was completed back in 2008. And to give you, I think, a sense of what the Canadians think about BPA, they have what I think is probably one of the clearest statements of any government agency anywhere. It's on a Canadian government website. But it's remarkably clear, and considering that there are so many hundreds and thousands of very highly technical studies and the reports typically are hundreds of pages long. But what the Canadian government said is, and this is a quote, "The current research tells us the general public need not be concerned. In general, most Canadians are exposed to very low levels of bisphenol A, therefore it does not pose a health risk." And then with respect in particular to infants, they further stated, "Science tells us that exposure levels are below those that could cause health effects." So that gives you their scientific view. What do they think about the safety of BPA? Now, the reason this is a little bit controversial and confusing is that you probably also know or have heard something about actions being taken by the Canadian government on BPA. And in particular, they have proposed, they actually haven't done this yet, but they have proposed to ban specifically polycarbonate baby bottles in Canada. But they have also made it very clear that they don't really have any concerns about the safety of any other products, including, in particular, products intended for infants and children, including things like sippy cups or canned infant formula or baby food. And they've been producing scientific papers and studies in the last year or so that reaffirm that view. So they've been very clear that they've made it clear that their proposed action on baby bottles is for precautionary reasons. They haven't found them to be unsafe, as indicated by that quote that I just read to you. But they are proposing for precautionary reasons to ban only polycarbonate baby bottles, nothing else. The other agency that I want to mention that I think is of some relevance is, and this is the most recent evaluation that really happened on BP, and it happened down in the state of California last year. You might be familiar with California law called Proposition 65, which requires the state to evaluate chemicals for their potential to cause reproductive and developmental toxicity or to cause cancer. And last year, July 15th, there was a meeting of the expert panel that is appointed by the California government to report out, discuss and conclude on their view of the science on bisphenol A. And what they concluded is that bisphenol A is not a reproductive or developmental toxicant. It would not be. It has not been listed under Proposition 65. And perhaps even more remarkable about that conclusion is that it was a unanimous decision by that panel. There were no dissenting panel members. And that's pretty remarkable because I think you don't see that for really any other chemical. Usually they're split votes, different views on the science. Here it was a 7-0 vote, totally unanimous, that bisphenol A should not be listed as a reproductive or developmental toxicant. Although many government agencies have already reviewed bisphenol A, they do remain vigilant and continue to monitor the science on bisphenol A. There is new science that is coming out all the time. So governments continue to monitor that. They review the science, and they update their views accordingly. And the one that perhaps is the most important for us here in the U.S. is that you certainly know that FDA is in the midst, or we hope maybe near the end of an assessment on BPA. They started it now about a year and a half ago. They published a draft report back in August of 2008, and they've been addressing some concerns about that report ever since. Now, we don't know specifically, but we anticipate that we will hear from FDA quite soon on their views. They're basically a conclusion from what they started a year and a half ago. I can't tell you what that is because they haven't told us yet, but we anticipate to hearing from FDA quite soon. And I think that's information you'll certainly want to hear about, and we're all waiting for it, so I expect you'll be happy to hear about it as well. In the U.S., though, it's not just FDA that has taken an interest in bisphenol A. EPA also has taken an interest, the Environmental Protection Agency. And this is part of a new program that they initiated back in just late September of this year, where the EPA Administrator, Lisa Jackson, announced a program under which chemicals would be reviewed to develop what EPA is calling action plans. And since this is a new program, I thought I would give you the definition of what this involves, because otherwise it would be not at all clear. But what they anticipate for chemicals that they review is the goals are to identify chemicals that pose a concern to the public, move quickly to evaluate them and determine what actions need to be taken to address the risks they may pose, and then initiate appropriate action. We know that BPA is one of the first chemicals that they're reviewing. We're also anticipating that we'll hear from EPA in the very near future. Again, I don't know specifically when that will be, and I can't tell you what they're going to say, but that's another piece of information that I think you'll be very interested to hear about in regard to your interests on BPA. There's a couple of other updated assessments that are underway. In Europe, I mentioned the European Food Safety Authority has evaluated BPA. They've actually had kind of an ongoing program for a number of years now. Their last views on BPA were published in October of 2008. We're aware that they are updating their views again. I don't know specifically when we'll see that update, but probably sometime in the first first 3 months of this year. And again, that's a very important assessment because that's kind of like the FDA in Europe. So what they say is very important, not just in Europe, but worldwide. So I think that's another opinion that you'll be interested in hearing about when it comes out. And then in Japan, we're also aware that the Japanese Ministry of Health, Labor and Welfare, that's kind of like the Japanese FDA, they also are updating their views on BPA. I don't have as much information on their timeline. I'm thinking something this year. I really don't know when they will conclude or issue any kind of a statement or report, but we're aware that they're also updating their views on the science, and they'll issue a new opinion of some sort, we think, later this year. And then finally, At the international level, the World Health Organization and the Food and Agriculture Organization of the UN, WHO and FAO, have announced that they will sponsor a joint assessment of BPA that will take place later this year. I think it's something like October of this year. And although that's not a regulatory body per se, their views, I think, are going to be very influential with governments worldwide. So that will take place later this year, and that will specifically focus on food contact products containing BPA. So in light of the frequency and the intensity of these regulatory reviews on BPA, I think it's not really clear what is the need and role for legislative action on BPA. There's so much going on with the regulators. They are very much keeping up to date on the science on BPA and very much monitoring that and updating their views as needed. And as I mentioned, those continue to come. So that's pretty much what I wanted to cover in my prepared comments, which actually aren't all that well prepared, but what I anticipated talking about. And I think I'll save everything else for your questions, and I don't know if you want to do that now or
wait
till
everyone.
We're going
to hear from all the speakers first.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
Or okay. Panelists first. Okay,
so
thank you.
Thank you, and we'll go to Dr. Bill Hoyle next.
Good afternoon. I am Dr. William Hoyle, and I'm here representing NAMPA, which is the North American Metal Packaging Alliance. And what I'd like to do is kind of expand a little bit on what Steve said about some of the studies that are out there. One of the things I think that's important to take from that is these aren't old. They're all recent. And the other part is they're not one-time studies. They're continuously updated and looked at. And the other part is that despite what some people like to say, is these studies do look at all of the data and then sort through it and come through. I'll come back to that a little bit later, but one of the things that we would like to do is from NAMPA's perspective is urge the committee to consider all of the relevant hazard information. Thus, in addition to just the relevant toxicology that Steve covered, there's also what I'll call the unintended consequences of banning epoxies. You got to think of the things that will happen if this would go away. And the other materials that are in the pipeline are nowhere near as well studied as these epoxies. So you got to think about all of those parts of it too. In coming back to that is over the last 10 years, BPA has been continuously reviewed and looked at as to determine if there is a health hazard there. And all of the relevant agencies around the world, not just FDA, not just Health Canada, but Japan, New Zealand, Australia, UK, Germany, all of them have come to the same conclusion that the BPA at the levels that exist in commerce today is safe. So with that, why do we use epoxy coatings? The use of epoxy coatings in metal packaging has real important and measurable health effects. It's important. What it does is I look at epoxy coatings for cans. I'll refer to it as an enabling technology. What it has enabled the packaging and food processors to do is process foods at high temperatures for short periods of time. The high temperature, short period of time, does two things. One, it maintains the nutrition, and two, it makes sure that since the way it is sterilized, it's microbiologically safe. In other words, it kills all those microorganisms. If you think back, and I don't want to, maybe I'm the old one here. If you go back 15, 20 years ago, you worried about dented cans, you had botulism and things like that. You don't hear about that anymore. Why? Because epoxies have taken that away. They essentially allow the can to be more flexible. You can dent it. It's flexible. It goes through operations so that these health hazards, so that if you, in the old coatings, what would happen is you would dent it, it would crack, and through those cracks, the food would then attack the metal and microorganisms would get in. You'd get this spoilage. That doesn't happen anymore. So the other part that I think important is to talk about, especially in a state that looks at itself as very green, is that this metal packaging technology utilizing epoxies is actually got two very important things going for it. One, the metal can is infinitely recyclable, including the coatings that are on the inside and outside of it. In other words, you just don't recycle it once. You can take that metal back, forth, and infinitely recycle it, both the aluminum and the steel. The other part of it is that, and this is studies that were actually done through one of the local food processors here in Salem, Oregon, is that they found that the metal can has the lowest carbon footprint. In other words, uses the least amount of energy to produce food that goes from the farmer's field to the consumer's table. I'll say that a different way. The metal can has enabled, with the way it is today, to take the least amount of energy required to produce that food and get it to the table in a nutritious form. So with that, I've given you the written testimony. I'll let you read that. I don't want to go back and read that. But what I would like to do is cover some things that are out there that you hear a lot about. And one of the myths, I'll call them myths, is that Japan metal packaging has moved totally away from epoxy coatings. Nothing could be farther from the truth. Epoxies in Japan are the most widely used coating technology. Even the PET cans that you hear a lot about, coated cans, require an epoxy coating between the metal and that PET in order for that coating to adhere so that it would function. The other myth that's quite prevalent is that there are replacement technologies out there. The fact is if they existed, we'd already be using them. We wouldn't have to worry about these kinds of things. We'd move over. The truth of the matter is that yes, there are certain coatings in niche products that can be used to replace epoxies. But of the number of specs, and I'll speak only in North America, for metal food packaging, there are about 15,000 specifications in North America to cover all of the food types, all the food packages that are out there. About 90% of those have epoxy in them. Now, the other one is that, okay, well, instead of using metal, let's move to glass. The problem is that when you move to glass, you got to close the top of it. All of the glass closures, for the most part, for processed food, are metal. When you open it up, you hear that little click. That food safety, important food safety function, requires, again, in about 90% of the closures, epoxy. And in the infant closures, particularly the meats and the ones that are fully processed, you cannot make them without epoxies. It cannot. They will not be sterile. I'll use another example about, work to get them replaced. Replacing a coating is not a simple function. It just doesn't happen overnight. All of these products are designed for a minimum shelf life of a minimum of 2 years. So if you're going to have a 2-year shelf life, there is no good accelerating testing that will test all of those 15,000 specifications. So you have to pack them and look at them and study them for a minimum of 2 years. That's in the pack. So getting it there, you can add, that's after you have the coating. So these things aren't going to be here in the next 6 months. And the industry, I'll give you a good example. There's one infant formula that essentially is used for the first food that almost a significant percentage of all infants in North America receive. The closure on that first food requires, because the formula, because of the nutrients and things that are added to it, requires a stainless steel disc inserted in it. That stainless steel disc is extremely expensive. For economic reasons, the company that manufactures that has been trying to find a replacement for the epoxy coating in that stainless steel disc. since 1992 and has not been successful. So the thought of replacing all these things just isn't going to happen. It not in any quick fashion. So the epoxy coatings, to stress this, are there for food safety reasons, to prevent problems, to enable sterilization and prevent microbiological difficulties. And if you think about the microbiological difficulties, just think of what you've read over the last few years about peanut butter, spinach, even some of the powders of in infant formula. Those things are not in the metal sterilized packaging, and any changes that require have a high potential to affect that sterility. They must undergo that study. And I'll give you a good example. And there was a particular material that was used in Europe and the United States for an infant closure. The European Union banned that material because they thought there was an easy replacement for it. That replacement was made, and in North America, our failure rate for an infant glass closure is approximately 1 in 1 million. The replacement that the European Union wanted to drive through took that 1 in 1 million failure rate down to about 1 in 1,000. We went to FDA, told them about this, and explained to them that to us was not acceptable. You cannot put infants at harm by making these changes and increasing that failure rate. That's the kind of failure rate we're talking about here in order to promote the food safety of this country. The other part that I think is very important is that in these economic times, changes, the metal food packaging actually is one of the packages that is relied upon very, very heavily through programs like the Women, Infant, Children, the WIC programs. A significant number of those packages are require epoxy coatings, both, and you'll hear from some of the people that, the only 3% of that or 5% of that's in the liquid. Well, both the liquid and powder have those coatings. It requires those coatings. It's not just the liquid. So the other part is when you get to hard times, like you've heard about Haiti and things like that in this morning's news, what's the first thing that's sent there? It's canned food because it's stable when you don't have any electricity. You also get canned and bottled water because that you can use those things. So in these kinds of emergencies, it's metal packaging food that is what's put out there. So with all that, I think the other thing that is important is that we talk about these agencies that you heard Dr. Henches talk about relied on only two industry-funded studies. It's not true. They actually looked through, from the number that I've seen, up to 1,700 different studies. As a matter of fact, Dr. Sue Barlow, who is with the European Food Safety Authority, actually said at the most recent ILSI meeting, she said, and I quote, "We looked at all of the studies, and based upon all of the data, it is still the opinion of EFSA that bisphenol A is safe for its intended use." And with that, I'll just pass and wait and try and answer any questions that you may have.
Okay. Thank you. Ms. Silveira, is that how I say your name right?
That was right. Thank you, Senator Dean Felder, for giving us this opportunity to come and speak to the committee on this issue. And, my name is Caroline Silveira. I'm with the Grocery Manufacturers Association. And I'll be much briefer than the doctors here. The Grocery Manufacturers Association represents the world's leading food, beverage, and consumer products companies. GMA promotes sound public policy, champions initiatives that increase productivity and growth, and helps to protect the safety and security of the food supply through scientific excellence. I'm here on behalf of GMA to emphasize the importance of BPA to the food industry and to consumers. I'm not here to talk about the science, which they've already done for you, but I'm here to ask this committee to please evaluate what's been said, evaluate the science,
applying the weight of the evidence approach, because this substance is that important in the safety and quality of our food supply. BPA allows for the production of safe, technologically effective, and commercially acceptable packaging that is essential for food safety and quality. Current exposure levels of BPA are safe for consumers and the environment, as demonstrated not only by repeated testing and review by qualified experts, but also by the history of over 60 years of commercial canned food safety. I would like to bring to the committee's attention BPA's critical function in protecting the integrity of certain metal packaging components. The committee should be aware that can coatings are necessary to protect public health. Without them, interactions between the metal and the can contents over time leads to corrosion and contamination of the food by dissolved metals, and to formation of container defects that allow entry into the product of microorganisms that cause spoilage or illness. The use of protective can linings slows down the rate of these interactions so much that modern canned foods, even high acid foods like fruits and vegetables, can be counted on to retain their nutrition, quality, and consumer acceptability for years under a wide range of environmental and handling conditions. Acidic foods and thermal processing present particular challenges. Although all major coating and can manufacturers are working continually to research and develop new coating chemistries for commercial food applications, epoxy coatings containing BPA still have unparalleled performance across a wide range of critical parameters, including toughness, adhesion, formability, and resistance under high temperature processing conditions. Because metal packaging enables a significantly longer shelf life than other kinds of packaging, canned goods are the mainstay for providing nutritious, economical food around the world and for special programs, for example, USDA's Women, Infants, and Children Assistance Program, food pantries, disaster relief, special military rations, etc. Again, epoxy coatings have been used safely to protect the world's food supply for over 60 years. GMA does not believe that banning BPA or any legislative action is warranted, and it would mislead and unnecessarily alarm Oregon citizens and would compromise the availability of safe, affordable, and nutritious foods. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for the panel?
Madam Chair.
Senator Hatch.
Thank you. Thank you for coming. Could you comment on the Consumer Reports? Is it December? Issue on BPA and its dangers in canned food and tests that evidently are controversial.
I can start with a couple of comments, and Bill may have some others. But first of all, there wasn't really anything new in that report. What they did is they measured the levels of BPA in, I don't remember how many, but 10 or 20, whatever, food products. That kind of data has been available for years, probably for decades, really. You can find many studies in the scientific literature and other places from government agencies that have very, very similar data. So there's nothing new in that regard.
Okay.
What was new or different is their interpretation of what that data means. And this is where they are really in direct conflict with the views of government bodies worldwide, whereas their analysis said that those levels were higher than a safe level. In other words, those would be harmful levels. There isn't any government around the world that would agree with that assessment. And to give you another way of looking at that, if you consider what is the exposure level that what is the level of BPA that we are exposed to from any sources, including canned foods, the best data available on that comes from a CDC program in which they measure the presence of, I don't know, several hundred chemicals in the human body. This is a very large-scale program, and one of the chemicals that they monitor is BPA. Well, what they found in what CDC reports is that the levels of BPA, total exposure from all sources, is extraordinarily low, and in fact, it's about 1,000 times below the safe level of BPA that has been set in Europe by the European Food Safety Authority, and that's a very up-to-date standard based on the science. So if you look at every government around the world, none consider that the levels of BPA that you'd find in canned foods are at a level even remotely close to being a level of concern. So it's the analysis of that Consumer Reports did that is different, but in very much in conflict with everyone else.
Do you have a follow-up?
Yes. Can you give us the situation in Minnesota where they have attempted to ban BPA containers or containers that contain BPA?
Minnesota did pass a bill last year in which the bill bans baby bottles and sippy cups.
Baby bottles and sippy
correct,
cups?
Correct, yep.
Correct.
I don't know if it's in effect. I think it's some kind of a staged system. Part of it's in effect for manufacturers, maybe. I don't know the details, but it's baby bottles and sippy cups only.
Okay. What kind of effect has that had, or are you in a position to say it's not working, it did work, or retailers weren't able to do this or that? Or
it's probably too early to say because it's brand new, but the situation with polycarbonate products is a little bit different than it is for epoxy resin can coatings, in that there always have been alternatives for polycarbonate baby bottles. They've always been around. For example, the glass baby bottles that I was raised on, they're still around. Not many people use them, perhaps, but they're still there. And there are other plastic products that are out there as well. They may be more expensive, they may not be as functional, but they're available. So babies aren't going to starve in Minnesota for lack of polycarbonate baby bottles. They may not have ones that are of the same quality. They may be more expensive. Some are certainly quite a bit more expensive.
I assume your industry advanced these same arguments that you're advancing here today in Minnesota or Chicago, which I think has similar.
Well, I think, as you've heard, our views really are based on the science. We ourselves do not think that the science supports that kind of a ban, and our views really rely quite heavily on the views of the government bodies around the world that have reviewed the science, none of which, based on the science, have found a reason to take action. There are no bans in Europe, Japan, based on the science, none in Australia, New Zealand, and even Canada, where they are proposing a ban on baby bottles. They've made it clear that's for precautionary reasons, not based on science. That quote that I gave you applies to baby bottles.
Okay. Thank you.
I have a couple of questions for you. First of all, I just want to clarify, I don't know if you've seen a copy of the LC draft. We don't have a bill number yet.
No.
But LC draft 116, because in your remarks you were talking about banning all these different products. It's very narrow in scope. It's more similar to the Minnesota bill, where it's for infants, children under 3 specifically, so it wouldn't affect all canned goods. So I just want to clarify that. And you can get a copy from my committee staff, Beth Petrino. A couple of questions I had while we still have a couple minutes. You had mentioned, and as I sort of joked, that I've read all of the studies. I tend to doubt that anybody's read all the studies. Maybe you have, but there's hundreds, close to thousands of them. What percentage of those studies that have actually been funded by your industry versus governments or the CDC? I mean, I'm pretty familiar with I attended the National Conference of State Legislators, had a biomonitoring conference, the CDC was there. I actually heard different information directly from the CDC about the concerns, about the levels and their concerns of their finding through these biomonitoring results. But I'm curious, from what I've heard, the majority of the studies, because the government doesn't have the money. I know certainly
right.
The state of Oregon doesn't, federal government. So would you say it's a fair statement to say that a vast majority of those studies are actually funded by the industry?
Of the many hundreds? Oh, no.
No. It's the other way around.
Yeah, very much the other way around. I actually don't know where the funding comes from for many of them. It's not stated in the publications, I don't know. But only a small, very small percentage are really industry-funded studies.
Well, that's sort of counter to what I've heard, because when I talk to the CDC, they don't necessarily have the funding. And because the way TSCA operates, it's the burden of proof is really on the industry to prove that it is not harmful versus the burden of proof on the government to prove that it's safe, which is what the opposite of the precautionary principle is, my understanding. I've worked with TSCA for many years. But anyway, I think we'll probably have some other people up here who can speak to that. Regarding the precautionary principle, it seems like some retailers and some manufacturers have actually taken on that precautionary principle. I know that some manufacturers have actually stopped using BPA water bottles. I know that there's some retailers that are not carrying baby products anymore with BPA. Again, it's not because there's a law that says that. It's because they've made a business decision that, based on concerns. So they've sort of adopted the precautionary principle. Do you have any comments on that or how that's affected your industry or made you look at alternatives? Because when you have large retailers that are sending the message, we don't think this is safe. Your response to that, I'd be curious.
I don't know if it's really the precautionary principle. I would characterize it maybe a little bit of a different way, in that it is a business decision for sure. But I think the business decision is based on the fact that retailers and product manufacturers, for that matter, are in the business of making or selling products, not defending the safety of chemicals. And so what I think many of them have done is really a form of conflict avoidance. Because of controversy, public pressure, they're simply switching to an alternative material just to avoid the controversy. And that's an interesting decision they're following, because I think, as was briefly mentioned, there really are no alternatives that have been tested as well as BPA and polycarbonate. So what we in effect are doing are switching from something that has been extraordinarily well tested, a substance that has been, the safety of which has been vetted by many government agencies recently around the world, switching over to things that don't even have anything remotely close to that same track record. So that's what's really happening, and that manufacturers and retailers are making those changes, not because they have concerns about the safety of the product, because they're just trying to avoid the controversy. There was a second half to your question. Oh, about what our industry is doing. I don't know if there's a single answer for that, but from the perspective of the chemical or plastics industry, our whole industry is really about innovation, making products that meet market needs, meet customer needs, so that people are going to buy and that add value to our lives. And so if we're not going to use polycarbonate, well, it's our industry that's going to make the alternative. So it's not like we're here defending something because somebody else is going to take the market. The chemical industry, the plastics industry, is going to make those alternatives too. We're here really defending the safety of our product based on the science. We feel very strongly that our products are safe based on a very long, very extensive scientific database. And if we give up the science, what do we have to rely on? That same science, those same scientific principles have to support the safety of everything else as well. So that's really what we're defending, is the safety of our product based on the science. So it's more principle-based.
Yeah. Let me add a little bit to what Steve just said, is that, yes, there is a lot of pressure to find things that don't have bisphenol A in it and move on to them. And the industry has been looking at that for a number of years, trying to find some. And yes, there are some things that have been found where there's niches that have been moved. But unfortunately, those are a small percentage of the products. The other part is that I think it's important is, as you find these new materials to replace bisphenol A, before they can go out to large-scale public use and become commercial, they have to go through the same FDA approval process that has approved bisphenol A. So you still have all that in front of you.
One thing I just want to be clear, because in your comments you sort of indicated that we are asking you to abandon the science. I think from everything I've seen, the science is not crystal clear, and that's part of why the federal government is right now reevaluating, you know, whether they're going to make recommendations or not to look at alternatives. You know, we have a long history of not using the precautionary principle, and that's part of our jobs, obviously, as policymakers. I lived through looking at the impacts of PCBs. I used to work on Superfund sites for many years, and so very familiar with parts per billion and parts per trillion. And unfortunately, it's a lot harder to go back and clean up or take things out of our human systems. Asbestos is another example, DDT. So that's why I think it's really important that we do it right to begin with. You know, I realize that BPA and polycarbonate has been around and resins for a long, long time, but certainly I think it's within our purview to make sure that we're protecting public health. Certainly the federal government, I think, is reevaluating the FDA as their stand on BPA, so I think we'll be looking at that very carefully. But certainly appreciate you all coming here today and flying out from different parts of I think some of you came from the East Coast, and we're going to be holding hearings in February, first week of February on this. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Next up, we are going to hear from Elizabeth Grossman, who is an environmental journalist, and she has, I can have her talk about a book, but she's written a book called Chasing Molecules, which is a very interesting read. I happen to have read it over my holiday break. That does talk about some of the alternatives. So thank you for coming here today. I know you have a very busy schedule as well.
Well, thank you, Senator Dingfelder, and colleagues for inviting me to speak to the committee today. It's an honor to be here. My name is Elizabeth Grossman, and I'm a freelance journalist and writer, and I specialize in environmental and science issues. Briefly, my work has appeared in a variety of publications, including Scientific American, The Washington Post, Salon, and The Nation. I'm a member of the Society of Environmental Journalists and National Association of Science Writers, and have a courtesy appointment with Portland State University's Center for Sustainable Processes and Practices, but otherwise I'm unaffiliated with any organizations or institutions. I was selected and am now serving as a volunteer member of the Education and Communication Work Group of the Centers for Disease Control's National Conversation on Public Health and Chemical Exposures. And as Senator Dingfeld mentioned, I'm also the author of some books, four of them, most recently Chasing Molecules, which happens to have been chosen by the publication Booklist as one of the top 10 science and technology books of 2009. The book explores the environmental and health impacts of a number of the most widely used synthetic chemicals and solutions to problems of chemical pollution that are offered by the field of green chemistry. Bisphenol A is among the chemicals discussed in the book, and my comments today reflect what I learned in the course of my research, both for the book and work going forward on the science and health effects of bisphenol A. So a bit of an overview. Bisphenol A was first synthesized in the 1890s and recognized as a synthetic estrogen in the 1930s, as is documented by papers published in the journal Nature in 1933 and 1936. At that time, bisphenol A was considered for public pharmaceutical use, but then put aside in favor of a more powerful synthetic estrogen called diethylstilbestrol, or DES. Subsequently, it was discovered that bisphenol A could be used as the building block for polycarbonate plastics, and as you've heard, to manufacture epoxy resins for other plastics and numerous other industrial and consumer product applications. Today, bisphenol A products are with us in countless electronic appliances, numerous other consumer products, including food and beverage containers. It's used as in dental sealants, as additives to other plastics, and also as paper coatings. Between 1980 and 2000, U.S. production of bisphenol A grew nearly five times. Today, over 6 billion pounds of bisphenol A are produced annually worldwide and go into products so widely used that scientists studying the chemical describe exposure to it as both ubiquitous and continuous. And exposure occurs because as these plastics age, when they are heated or when they come into contact with acidic or basic substances, certain foods or detergents are an example, bisphenol A can leach out of these finished products. And this leaching has been documented in numerous laboratory studies involving polycarbonate animal cages, polycarbonate bottles, and in tests of the epoxy resins that line food and beverage cans. In its ongoing biomonitoring studies of synthetic chemicals in Americans, the CDC has found BPA in the majority of people tested. The survey reported from 2003 to 2004 found BPA in 95% of the Americans tested. A study published last year in Environmental Health Perspectives, a National Institute for Environmental Health Sciences publication, found that 1 week of polycarbonate bottle use increased urinary BPA concentrations by two-thirds. And that exposure, it was found, from cold beverages from polycarbonate bottles is associated with a substantial increase in urinary BPA concentrations, irrespective of exposure to BPA from other sources. Simply, this means that drinking from bottles made out of this material increases exposure. Another study, also published in Environmental Health Perspectives last year, found bisphenol A in the urine of over 75% of premature infants being cared for in a hospital's neonatal unit. Numerous additional studies, biomonitoring studies, have found comparable results. And these exposures prompt concern because of the way in which bisphenol A can interact with the hormones, genetic mechanisms, and genetic receptors responsible for regulating and maintaining numerous vital bodily systems. Among these are reproduction, development, metabolism, as well as neurological, immune, and cardiovascular systems. So because of its ability to interfere with and therefore disrupt these functions, BPA has been identified as an endocrine disruptor. As such, BPA has been linked to thyroid hormone disruption, obesity promotion, fertility, and reproductive development, among other effects. Concern over these effects is compounded because, as Linda Birnbaum, former director of experimental toxicology at the EPA, who's now director of the National Institute for Environmental Health Sciences, stated in a recent interview with Chemical and Engineering News, BPA is but one of more than two dozen chemicals people are exposed to that act similarly. Such exposure now occurs on a daily basis throughout life, often beginning before birth. And one of the things which makes assessing these exposures challenging is that the endocrine system is complex and our understanding of how it works continues to evolve. Among what scientists have learned in the past 20 years is that timing, as well as dose or level of exposure of a hormone or endocrine-disrupting chemical, is crucial to determining the outcome of that exposure. Exposure at one stage of development or point in the hormonal cycle may produce one outcome. The same exposure at another stage may produce no effect or a very different outcome. So for endocrine-disrupting chemicals, of which BPA is one of the many we are now exposed to, there are what scientists call critical windows of vulnerability when exposure can set the stage for future adverse health outcomes. Scientists have also now learned from numerous studies that a low level or low dose of exposure to an endocrine disruptor may trigger an effect that a high dose of the same chemical may not. A high level of a chemical may overwhelm a genetic receptor, thereby producing no effect, while a small amount can prompt the receptor to respond, thereby setting in motion the chain of effects that can lead to a specific health outcome. One stage of life where timing is particularly important to endocrine-disrupting chemicals is early life, prenatally, during infancy and childhood. And this has also now been demonstrated in numerous laboratory studies, including studies that show that exposure to bisphenol A at a particular stage of development could influence future health of not only one, but two subsequent generations. One study that was done by Dr. Patricia Hunt at Washington State University showed that exposure to bisphenol A could affect the egg cells developing within the fetus of pregnant mice. In other words, it was affecting the mother, her daughter, and her daughter's future children as well. Growing evidence of early life impacts of such synthetic chemical exposures prompted a meeting in 2007 of international experts in environmental health and medicine. The meeting concluded with publication of what's called the FARO statement. That's where they met. And it concludes by saying, the accumulated research evidence suggests that prevention efforts against toxic exposures to environmental chemicals should focus on protecting the embryo, fetus, and small child as highly vulnerable populations. Given the ubiquitous exposure to many environmental chemicals, there needs to be renewed efforts to prevent harm. Prevention should not await definitive evidence of causality when delays in decision-making would lead to the propagation of toxic exposures and their long-term harmful consequences. Current procedures, therefore, need to be revised to address the need to protect the most vulnerable life stages through greater use of precautionary approaches to exposure reduction. And a workshop held in March of 2009 by the German Federal Environmental Agency to assess bisphenol A came to a similar conclusion, saying that to reduce the possible risk associated with BPA, precautionary reduction of exposure for some groups of humans like children, particularly in neonatal intensive care units, seems to be urgent. You may hear and read that some studies have suggested that the health outcomes observed as a result of bisphenol A exposure in laboratory animal studies may not be a valid indicator of outcomes in human exposure, but numerous scientists, in fact, virtually all the scientists I spoke to, stressed the fact that the genetic mechanisms affected by bisphenol A and other endocrine-disrupting chemicals work comparably in all animals. And, in fact, there's a paper that is now being published by the International Journal of Hygiene and Environmental Health, reporting on the conclusions of the German Federal Environmental Agency workshop that I mentioned earlier, that says, quite plainly, the available data suggests that rodent data are appropriate for modeling human exposure to BPA and therefore cannot be dismissed for use in human risk assessment. And they came to the same conclusion in terms of how low-dose effects in animal studies could be used for human risk assessment. Another challenge of assessing the health effects of endocrine-disrupting chemicals like bisphenol A, is that everyone who's exposed to these chemicals will not develop or exhibit health conditions associated with that exposure. In addition, many of these health conditions are caused by multiple factors, including multiple chemical exposures. And one of the problems that Dr. Birnbaum, Linda Birnbaum, often points out is that to date, most of our research is focused on looking at the effects of one chemical at a time, when in fact we are all in reality exposed to multiple chemicals throughout our lives, typically from before birth. And for individuals whose systems may already be compromised or vulnerable, what might otherwise be a relatively minor impact could have a profound effect. So in summary, there is now substantial evidence that environmental conditions play a role in every complex disease and that environmental pollutants have a profound effect on human health. And it's clear that a number of chemicals present at levels in the environment, including bisphenol A, can disrupt genetic programming in ways that can lead to reproductive, metabolic, immune system, neurological, cardiovascular, pulmonary, and developmental health problems. Some of these effects, depending on when they occur, can be irreversible and remain with an individual throughout their life. And finally, exposure to endocrine disruptors has become so prevalent and have been linked to so many adverse health outcomes, among them diabetes, obesity, as I mentioned, cardiovascular disease and reproductive problems, as well as certain cancers, that just about a month or so ago, in November 2009, the American Medical Association adopted the resolution promulgated earlier last year in June by the Endocrine Society that says the science demonstrates that there is cause for concern regarding the health effects of endocrine-disrupting chemicals, and it calls on the AMA to work towards policies that regulate the production of endocrine-disrupting chemicals and limit the public's exposure to these substances and their associated potential health hazards. And then the statement goes on to say that the Endocrine Society is concerned that the public may be placed at risk because critical information about potential health effects of these chemicals is being overlooked in the development of federal guidelines and regulations, and urges the AMA to work towards new policies that will decrease the public's exposure to endocrine-disrupting chemicals. So, in other words, the medical community is urging policymakers to be proactive in their efforts to reduce these exposures. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for Ms. Grossman? Okay, I have the chair's prerogative, I guess, is to ask the last question. In your book, you talked about what's going on in Europe with REACH. Can you maybe talk a little bit about that and their decision to sort of take on more of the precautionary principle?
I will say I am not an expert in REACH, but the whole idea behind it is to ask manufacturers to shoulder much more of the responsibility than has historically been true of proving their products safe, rather than putting the burden of that proof on the public or another group that may feel that the harm has been caused. So that's the basic principle behind the precautionary aspects of REACH, as I understand it.
And are you familiar with what's being proposed in Canada?
In terms of BPA being added to a toxic substance list, mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah.
Can you maybe talk a little bit about that?
Well, as the previous speaker said, there's a lot of conflicting and controversial information. Environment Canada has done quite a lot of testing of containers that use bisphenol A, and their tests, as far as I've understood them, have indeed recorded leaching of bisphenol A from those products. Obviously, the controversy arises over whether those levels are going to cause a direct cause and effect kind of recordable harm, but as you've previously heard, the Canadian government has proposed adding bisphenol A to a toxic substance list. So again, there's lots of conflicting and controversial information.
All right. Thank you very much, Ms. Grossman. Appreciate you taking time out of your busy schedule as well. And we have one more speaker in regards to looking at toxics, and that's from the Department of Environmental Quality, Palmer Mason, and we also have Kevin Masterson. He's going to update us on what DEQ is doing as part of their toxics reduction strategy. This is our last speaker today, so we might actually end a little bit early. Thanks for coming, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Everybody wants to get started. Okay, go ahead.
Well, thank you, Chair Dingfelder and members of the committee. My name is Palmer Mason. I'm with the Department of Environmental Quality, and I have with me Kevin Masterson, who is the agency's toxics coordinator. We're going to talk a bit about DEQ's agency-wide toxic reduction strategy. This is an effort by DEQ to identify toxic chemicals that are a priority across multiple programs within our agency, and then engage our stakeholders in a process of putting together the information about the potential sources and pathways of those toxic chemicals and the effects that they may have on human health and the environment, and then engage further the stakeholders in a conversation about possible reduction options that may be appropriate. And so Kevin has a presentation that will go in more detail.
Can I ask people who are standing near the door to make sure the door is closed? It's a little hard to hear. Okay, thank you. Kevin?
Thank you, Chair Dingfelder and members of the committee, for the opportunity to talk to you about our toxics reduction strategy at DEQ. And as you already know from the presentations you've heard before, the scope of issues related to toxic chemicals.
Kevin, can you just state your name for the record, please?
Oh, sure. My name is Kevin Masterson. I'm the agency toxics coordinator at the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality. So the scope of chemical production and chemical use in the country is quite huge, as you know, with 80,000 chemicals registered on the Toxic Substances Control Act inventory and about 800 active ingredients registered as pesticides in the state of Oregon under a different statute, while at the same time our Clean Water Act, Clean Air Act, other regulatory programs that are designed to manage pollution at the end stage of a chemical only address a very small fraction of the overall number of chemicals out there. And for example, 156 toxics are regulated by our standards under the Clean Water Act. There are about 7 current use pesticides that have in-stream water quality standards out of the 800 active ingredients. So we don't have a regulatory handle on these chemicals necessarily. Not that we need to regulate all of them, but we certainly need to develop a strategy that addresses the larger scope of the issues related to toxic chemicals rather than just this narrow universe. In addition, recent monitoring, as many of you probably know, has shown a wide range of toxics found in humans, fish, water, and sediment. New research on emerging contaminants indicates that there are chronic health effects potentially at even low levels of exposure. So those are some of the concerns about toxics, and the reason why we're developing this strategy is not just because of the scope of the problem, but also we think it just makes a lot of sense for DEQ to be developing a cross-program approach to managing toxic chemicals. The 4 major reasons why we've undertaken this effort is, one, these chemicals don't respect our arbitrary regulatory boundaries that we've established through the Clean Water Act, Clean Air Act, etc. Mercury is a great example where pollutants are released to the air, hit the land, and then run off to the water. So we need a much more integrated approach. We want to get beyond a chemical-by-chemical approach to the problem by taking a much more comprehensive look at these chemicals and address a range of them rather than just one chemical at a time. We also think this improves the efficient use of agency resources, especially in these tight budget times. We really want to focus on the highest priorities, and we needed to take a strategic approach in order to determine what those priorities are. And finally, we think that having a strategy in place allows us to be much more proactive than reactive if we have set sort of the stage for managing toxics in the direction that we want to take. We'll be less in a position of always reacting to the latest proposal that's out there from various stakeholders. Not that we wouldn't want to incorporate it if it fits in with our overall strategic objectives. So this graphic illustrates how that toxic reduction strategy would be a unifying framework for our toxics programs throughout the agency, both assessment and reduction programs. And under these boxes within each of our divisions and programs, you can see individual efforts that are ongoing right now. These are some of the more current initiatives that we've undertaken. It's certainly not by any means an exhaustive list of all of our toxics programs, but it gives you an idea of some of the ones we're working on. And when we're done with this strategy, we'd like to see much more a connection between these boxes. We'd have arrows going back and forth between the boxes to show how all of the programs are integrated. So we identified seven major steps in developing this toxics reduction strategy. We're in the midst of stage number 3 and 4 right now. We've identified high-priority toxic chemicals, which I'll talk about in a minute. We're in the process of identifying sources and pathways to the environment and to humans. We also want to identify the gaps in current programs because some of them are working quite well, and we want to be able to advance those to the extent possible, whereas others might not be addressing some of the highest priorities. So that allows us to shift some of our resources towards those highest priorities. We also want to be able to look at how we can modify or come up with new programs. We had a workshop in November where we collected a lot of ideas from a range of different stakeholders. And then once we've got all of those recommended strategies put together, we'd like to develop an implementation and communication plan that sets forth who the lead agency is going to be, implement each of those initiatives, what it will cost, and what the timeline is for implementing it. And, of course, we will be presenting this to our commission and doing some public outreach before we implement the strategy. So in terms of where we are now, as I mentioned, we're in the process of assessing some of the sources and releases of toxics in the state. We've established an external stakeholder group that has met several times to help us identify some of the priorities and to help guide our effort. We recently established an initial what we call toxics focus list that I'll talk about in just a second that allows us to identify the highest priorities at this time. And finally, we are assessing those gaps that I mentioned in current programs and compiling a whole list of ideas that people have sent us, as well as those that have been generated inside the agency. We hope to complete the draft of the strategy by the spring of this year and have some public comment during the summer and finalize it in the fall. So in terms of how we developed our agency-wide list of priority toxics, we decided rather than come up with a brand new process from scratch that we would rely on existing lists that are already out there that we've developed or that we've worked with other agencies on in the past. So in looking at what was already out there, we identified 11 different program lists that prioritized chemicals. And what we decided to do in terms of identifying our initial priorities was to take a look at those 400 chemicals that were on what we're calling our base list and look at those first that are a cross-program concern that really have a major focus for multiple programs within DEQ. So we came up with this programmatic criterion, which says that if a chemical is a priority for at least 3 of those 11 programs and 2 of our 3 major divisions, that is air quality, water quality, land quality, then it would automatically get on our focus list because it would be a demonstrated cross-media concern. And when we did that, made that programmatic cut, we came up with about 135 chemicals, but it gets reduced significantly when we group them by chemical class. For instance, we have 20 or 30 PCBs. Realistically, we're not coming up with strategies to reduce each of those individual PCBs, but rather the whole class. And so that is the starting point for our strategy, is those 135 chemicals. The remaining chemicals on the list, which is about 265, we've developed a more involved process for taking a look at them, and some of those could end up on the focus list. The first screen that we'll have is to look at whether any of those chemicals exceed environmental standards like water quality standards, air quality standards. And that will affect, we think, about 7 or 8 of the chemicals that didn't make the initial programmatic cut, and we'd recommend that those get on the focus list. For the other ones, it would be a much more involved process, and some of them we don't even have much data on at all in terms of their release in Oregon or their presence in Oregon, so we would recommend that we collect more data, and that's why we have that data needs list box right there. And this list is dynamic. I mean, just like our strategy, it is going to be a living document, a living process, and so we will be looking at new chemicals. We'll also be taking chemicals off the list if we feel as though they have been addressed sufficiently and that they're no longer a problem for Oregon. So in terms of these 135 chemicals, we decided to divide them into functional group categories to help us get a handle on what types of chemicals they are and how they're used in society at large. So we came up with 7 different categories that you see listed here, including consumer product constituents, legacy and current use pesticides, industrial chemicals, metals, volatile organic compounds, which are things like solvents, and combustion byproducts. And when we did that, we came up with a pretty diverse mix of different types of chemicals that fall into all of those categories. In terms of what types of toxics reduction actions will be included in the strategy, right now we're in the phase of looking at just about everything and telling everybody that all options are on the table, including regulatory and voluntary programs, incentive programs, data gathering programs. We'll be looking at both point source and non-point source activities, source reduction and control, and monitoring and data collection. In terms of the underlying guiding principles for which actions we're going to select and recommend, we are going to emphasize those strategies that address multiple priority chemicals, because it's much more efficient, obviously, to develop and implement strategies that cover a number of different chemicals and pollutants. We want to build on those existing efforts that work well already, so we're not reinventing the wheel if we don't need to. And then we want to, of course, prevent pollution at the source where possible. This graphic kind of illustrates the life cycle of a toxic chemical, and as you can see, the focus of most environmental regulations is at the end of that life cycle. Clean Water Act, Clean Air Act, RCRA, Superfund really are focused on the generation of pollutants and how we manage them after the fact, how we collect, dispose, treat, incinerate, etc. We do have a few programs at DEQ that go up that chain a little bit and deal with use and purchase of chemicals, but they're voluntary education programs. And as you can see, there's a lot more potential opportunity for addressing these chemicals further up the life cycle. So we want to take a look at what those possibilities are, because it's much more efficient to address those things before they become a problem in the environment. Lastly, I just wanted to provide an example of how this strategy will be implemented for a particular chemical and a class of chemicals, in this case DDT and its breakdown products, which falls into the legacy pesticide category. We want to look at the sources, obviously, first, and then key the reduction strategies off of those sources. And in the case of DDT, as you can see, there are both rural and urban concerns in terms of erosion and runoff. DDT was used in a variety of different environments throughout the years, and some rural land is now urban land, so we want to look at the erosion and runoff concerns on all types of land and develop strategies around those sources. In addition, there's spills and leaks from old product containers that are sitting in people's barns and have been leaking or potentially leaking for a number of years. And we would like to see more of those chemicals coming out of people's barns. The last time we put on one of these collection events, we collected 18,000 pounds of waste, and the numbers keep going up. So I'm not really sure why there's more of this out there, but I think people are just starting to get become aware of different opportunities to bring this material in. So that's an example of how we would deal with those products. And, of course, there's a variety of different types of erosion control opportunities through existing agriculture water quality management plans, the total maximum daily load program that we could emphasize more in terms of legacy pesticides, and working with NRCS, the Natural Resource Conservation Service, and looking at all the tools and incentives that they have available. So this is just one example of how we would look at strategies for a particular class of pollutants. And that's pretty much all we had.
You have copies of the focus list.
Yeah. Palmer, did you want to add anything?
Well, I was just going to add that if the committee's interested, we have copies of the focus list that Kevin mentioned that identifies the 135 chemicals, or if you group them,
just
54.
Send it to Beth and
absolutely,
we'll get it. So, okay. Any questions for Kevin or Palmer? I appreciate it. I wanted to just say, really, I want to thank DEQ for, I think, and DHS, I think, and ODA. There were several agencies involved, but I think you were the lead on the toxics conference, where there was over, 300 people?
About 200, yeah.
It was a lot. I mean, that was when I was there, a packed room. So I just want to say there's a lot of interest, obviously, from the public in this, and appreciate the work that you're doing. Please make sure and keep Beth in the loop in this committee abreast. We'll probably have you come back in possibly May or this summer to give an update as you move forward. But really pleased to see that this is a top priority for the agency, and I know that you're working, coordinating also with Department of Human Services, because they're sort of the link that wasn't up there, because they're working on trying to also identify the, as far as the public health connection there. It's very apropos given the presentation we just had before. But I will look forward to seeing the results as you move forward, and certainly appreciate your hard work, and glad to hear that we're finally moving forward with a comprehensive strategy, a much-needed one.
Great.
Thank you,
thank you,
gentlemen. And with that, unless there are any questions, okay, with that, I will adjourn the Senate interim.